You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
Something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I would suggest that these shoes and bare feet, both as being Freemasonic symbols, triggers, but it's also, I would say, possibly like a business card that they leave behind them when these are the operations.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Ole Damegaard and Kevin Barrett. Today's show, The Global Tour of Terror, a theory of false flag operations. Ole Damegaard and Kevin Barrett were panelists on the Deep Truth Visionaries Speak Out online video conference of July 9th, 2018, produced by No Lies Radio. We begin with a presentation by Swedish investigative journalist and author Ole Damegaard on Find the Clues and Connect the Dots, on forensic evidence of manipulated and staged photographs in the media reports of global terror events. Ole Damegaard.
So, I would like to share to you what might be a super boring presentation or something of immense value. I hope the later. But, well, here we go. I call it, like always, a global tour of terror, because this is what I've been tracking down for so many years. And I think that I might have come up with something that can help reveal what is really going on. So, prepare yourself. A global tour of terror, revealing the agenda. So the question is, what is actually going on in the world as such? And also, as with any crime, any violent crime and so, you have to look at the forensic evidence. That is what I've been trying to do, and really find the specific of the leads, the dots, the clues, whatever, that can show us what's really going on. What is the actual truth of different events? And when you look at crimes, I would say sometimes you have to look for, like if it's a serial killer you're tracking down or a serial rapist or so on, you find for similarities, symmetries in the crime scene, similarities, clues that are identical left on different crime scenes and so on, that will help you point out who the guilty part in is in this. And so I've named this presentation, Find the Clues and Connect the Dots. Now, we're being told that the world is filled with Muslim terrorists looking more or less like this, or the legal version underneath. So I ask you, would an fundamentalist group be able to affect Western media? Would they be able to control what images are being used in Western media, in newspapers all over the Western world, or not? I would suggest that that would be way beyond their control. Their part would be blowing themselves up and so on, but they could not affect media in a distinguished way. So let's see, what are we seeing here? And over the years, I've done this for 30-odd years, and one of the things that I found is that I keep running into these shoes. Everywhere where there's an alleged terror attack, there are these shoes that are left there, normally more or less invisible. They're there somewhere in the image, but it's not what you're looking at, but they're always there. And one of the things that I found in my research was that I was contacted by Freemasons that told me that this is actually a Freemasonic sign that shows you one shoe off of a victim or somebody involved. One shoe off means that they're taking part of this operation voluntarily. Two shoes off means that it's a homage to the sacred space where this is being carried out. But it's one step further, I would say, because these shoes appear on so many different areas. And so if we go back in history, the shoes, what are the shoes a sign of? And when you look at in a historical way, the first time I really encountered these shoes were when it comes to the Holocaust, where they have been used massively in history books and so on, where we keep seeing these mountains of shoes of people that are said to have been killed in these death camps and so on. Also, other war zones like the Balkan War and so on, the shoes appear. You got in Honduras, the death squads, the shoes appears and so on. So it seems like the shoes are a sign that keeps being repeated. Then I can really recommend a film, a movie called Wag the Dog. It's a very, very interesting film with Robert De Niro and Dustin Hoffman. And it's about how when a president is in a tricky spot, how they can call in experts and set up a diversion. In this case, it's a movie where it's almost identical to the situation with Bill Clinton in the White House and Monica Lewinsky, and how they needed to divert the attention away from this disaster. And so in the movie, they very realistically create a war that doesn't exist against Albania because it's so far away that most people in the States haven't even got a clue where it is. So they do that in media. They stage the whole thing, divert the attention away. And one of the key things in this movie is the shoe here as well. They come up with this theme of a shoe. They throw up some shoes over a telephone pole and up in the some trees and so on. They even get Willie Nelson to play a song like they make out. It's like recorded in the 1920s called The Old Shoe. And the hero, the returning war hero that they need also in this drama, they always need heroes when they do the storytelling of these alleged events. And the guy that they bring home, he's played by Woody Harrelson, and he's called The Old Shoe as well. So the shoe is very, very central in this. And I've done many interviews on this theme. And lately, I also done interviews with a CIA, a former whistleblower, former private contractor called Cody Snodgrass, which I think is one of the most important whistleblowers in modern times, at least at this point. Very, very incredible information he's coming out with. And we were doing a show together, and I kept talking about these shoes. And then he said, have you ever thought of that when people are being broken down in mind control experiments, for instance, like they're being created into assassins or fall guys or whatever, what they do in these very brutal methods to create patsies that can be used for whatever, they break them down through horrific torture, sexual abuse, verbal abuse, you name it, absolute pure pain. And while doing it, one of the things they do is they hold up like symbols in front of the person that are being subjected to this horrific treatment. And this symbol, they always use the same symbol for this same individual. It could be like upside down swimming dolphins or wavy lines or whatever. And this then becomes a trigger, like a trigger image that can be used with this individual to trigger him into becoming in that alternative state of mind, or alternative personality can then be used to activate this agent. I mean, they can activate a second part of the personality with a trigger in itself. And Cody said, I believe that these shoes are there as a trigger so that every time we see an alleged terror event or anything horrific that are really fear boosting in the population, they leave these shoes there as a trigger. So I'm asking myself, that made a lot of sense. So I'm asking myself, is this possible? Are these shoes that are left there in so many different images there to trigger us, to keep us in fear mode? And if so, is it being used sort of in an organized way? Is it possible that we're seeing alleged terror attacks, war zones, suicide bombers around the planet that are actually coordinated and are actually where these shoes are left there as a trigger through media to keep the rest of us in massive fear mode, constant fear mode? I ask you, and this is what I would like this presentation to be about. So here we see also articles in the newspapers, they use the shoe what has a shoe to do anything with a terror attack? For instance, here, which countries have had the most terrorist attacks? What on earth has a shoe to do with that? If I used to work as a photographer and journalist. If I'd come home with a photo of a shoe after an alleged terror attack, I would have get my butt kicked. I mean, I would have been fired saying, what were you thinking? I mean, come on, get a photo of what is really important. So why the shoe? We look at the different countries and so on where alleged terror attacks have happened, suicide bombers, alleged suicide bombers and so on. And for instance, in 2016, it's the same countries more or less now. We had Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Nigeria, Syria, Somalia, India, the Philippines, Yemen, Thailand are the main ones. And then the rest of the world has about 10% of them. So let's have a look at different countries and see if we're able to find these shoes. So here we have the Westminster Bridge attack, where very, very bizarrely, you have like here to the right, this woman is trying to save this man after this alleged attack. And what have they done? She's giving him mouth to mouth and so on. But before that, she's made absolute sure to take off his shoe, put them very neatly on the pavement and right there for the photographer to get a shot of the shoes there. We have different victims. I'm just showing a few here because I've got hundreds and hundreds where victims are coming with one shoe off. That means that that person is taking part of this operation voluntarily, if it is one of these signs. Also, the shoes are left everywhere. We go continue here. It's not all of these photos I'm going to show to you are different attacks, different alleged suicide bombers, and so on, not from the same event. So here we have the London Bridge attack, which was not the same as the Westminster Bridge. What do we see? We find a shoe placed extremely central in one of the images. And these shoes, they just have to be there in a subtle way for us to be, for our subconscious to grab it and get it in there. Here we have the Manchester arena bombing, the alleged bombing there. Please, every time I say the name of a terror attack, add the word alleged before it. So here, the shoes, the shoes, the shoes. Here's one of the woman here. It said that she was hit by shrapnel from the bomb, and they show the shoe. We stand together, the shoes are there. People that come out from there, they come without the shoes. Why would you take your shoes off if you're trying to escape or you come out of an attack? Here we have the Westminster Bridge attack where a police officer is said to have been stabbed to death, where an MP is out there instead of the normal medical people here, the ambulance drivers and so on, doing CPR. This man, the MP, is doing CPR and later named a hero, once again, the hero. He was knighted by the Queen and so on. He was also in charge of when a lot of the English tourists was killed in Tunisia. He was also in charge of that whole operation. And here we have like their feet are almost like a religious old painting. The feet are the center of the image. So there was one guy that had tried to save his life. He does not appear on any photos, but he was invited to the TV studios next morning. And how did he come into the studio? He came without no shoes because he said he lost the shoes when he tried to save this police officer. I don't know how you lose your shoes doing that. And then, of course, when he was invited for the first time on national TV, I would suggest, were they the only shoes you had? Maybe you should put on some other ones, get some, buy some, take some sandals, at least socks. No, here he came bare feet into the studio and his bare feet was part of the conversation. I would suggest that these shoes and bare feet, both as being Freemasonic symbols, triggers, but it's also, I would say, possibly like a business card that they leave behind them when these are the operations. So in media in England, what was the images that was being spread on the newspapers? They were the shoes. You see how this strange blood underneath it, there's no blood coming from the body, but here we have this alleged victim. You can also see that these shoes have hardly been walked on. I believe that this was not a real body, but here you have the image, the shoe again, triggering. Madeleine McCann, this girl that was kidnapped and nobody really knows what happened to a very famous case in England and has spread all over the world. When that was lately reported in the news, what was the image used? The shoes. Then here, some latest thing, also when it comes to other events, like here is an alleged accident from an airplane show, an exhibition where it said that the plane crashed. What is the photo? Is it of the crashed plane? Is it of some cars that is set to turn on fire of the victims? No, a shoe. Here we have, very recently, there was two police officers stabbed in Greenock in England. What is the photo? The shoe. There's a whole wave of stabbings in the UK at the moment where the shoes are there every single time. The shoe. And then when Theresa May, the Prime Minister of England, when she celebrated Christmas, what did she put on top of a Christmas tree? A shoe. I mean, who does that? If it's not a message being sent out there, also for the people in the know, people that are involved in these operations, are this sort of like a secret communication system that every time they send out this message, people in the know around the world, they will see, okay, that's our operation, that's another one, that's another one. I have not been able to prove this, but I'm asking the question. So here, let's go to France. We got the Charlie Hebdo. What is outside the car of the terrorist? A shoe. When they run over, they're said to have shot this police officer. They run back, and the guy on the passenger seat, what does he do? He picks up the shoe, throws it in the car, and they take off, even though he has got two shoes on and the other shoe as well. So there was an additional shoe, and why did he even bother to pick it up? You got other terror events in France, the shoe. You got the riots afterwards. You got like almost an eyes wide shut individual in the black cape there at the bottom right. And right in front of it, a shoe. And then you got the Bataclan one, shoes again, left there. And more or less always Nike shoes. It's a repeated thing. Then you had the Bataclan massacre on November the 13th. 2015. And what is the symbol? You got like running blood on the wall and somebody has goose and put there. If I got back to the newspaper with photos like this and said, I want this photo, the editor would say, get out of here. No way. We want good photos. What the hell were you doing collecting those shoes? What is up with these shoes? So you had to ask yourself, how come that they have been published in mainstream media in these countries? Here we have Ireland, a recent shooting of the dad of a top level boxer. Then you have from many of the alleged bombings by IRA, the victims, what is there? The shoes. We go to Norway. What is the image that we are being shown from the mass shootings in Norway? Shoes. Italy. Here, it is one story. I believe that there are so many stories being spread in media, mainstream media at the moment, that are just not true. They're just there as part of the whole psyop into freaking us out, into believing this whole thing with a mass invasion of immigrants, all the violence, the crime rates going up. It's the same in all Western European countries, the same stories. And here it's said that in Italy, these people put a homeless guy on fire. So why? What would you take the photo of? The burnt body, the crime scene? No, shoes. And here, after the alleged riots, there was a big football game, Juventus. What happened there? The shoes. I also want to point out, when we talk about Italy, that at this very moment, the Bilderberg meeting 2018 is taking place in Turin. And every single year, just about a week or so before, there's been an alleged terror attack. I would suggest, as a diversion for us to look the other way, look away from what is actually going on. Denmark. Here we have shoes lined up. This is not about the terrorism, but this is about people who have died because they cut down on so many different areas in a society. So why the shoes? And also, who can control the media in all of these countries? You have to ask yourself, what is going on here? The Belgium airport attack, the shoes. Afterwards, there was 9,000 shoes put out in a Brussels square, had nothing to do with each other, but the shoe is used once again. Benghazi, Libya, what are the photos we're being shown after this whole thing? The shoes. Who would bring like a rubber boot and just a shoe and put it right in the center of the image? You got the crime scene in the background. What is the photographer doing taking photos of shoes instead of being where he should be at the scene of whatever happened? Here, another one down to the right, another event, the shoes in the foreground. Spain, alleged terror attacks, different ones. What do we see? The shoes. The shoes, the shoes, the shoes. We go to Iraq. I mean, this is the home of the most terror attacks ever. What do we see? The shoes. And look at how they're positioned. It's not just a shoe. It is there to tell you something. It is there for a reason. And this lady's shoe to the left, if it was part of that, wouldn't there be blood spatter on top of it? Or is that one put afterwards? I would suggest when you look at it, it is put there afterwards. This is a staged crime scene. If it's real or not, I don't know, but that one is sending out a message. In Sweden, the alleged truck attack here, shoes, shoes, shoes. Then after, there was a second truck attack in Sweden that most people hadn't heard about. This truck was abandoned there. And when you look at the aerial footage of that truck, what is hanging on the telephone line on top of the truck? A pair of trainers. And here there were some alleged riots in Sweden a while ago with alleged Nazis and immigrants. And what do we see here? Once again, a pair of shoes in front of the ambulance. A normal professional photographer, if the shoes were standing there, he would kick them to the side and take a photo of the ambulance, not there. And you will see there's an additional shoe in front of the left front tire. What are they doing there? Here we have a girl, 11-year-old, that is said to have been killed at the truck attack in Stockholm. I heard there's some horrific images of a torn body, very, very horrific images of a torn body of a child after this event. But I've had doctors look at that, people that have been working at emergency wards for more than 20 years, and she told me that is not a real human body because there would have been a total bleed out. The body is totally massacred and more or less no blood whatsoever. So he said that is not a real body. And then the dad of this alleged victim, he's only done one interview, and in the interview, one of the first things that the interviewer says that, yeah, and on this day she was so happy because you had just given her a pair of shoes, didn't you? And he says, yeah. So the shoes, the shoes. Here, mass shooting at a nightclub, the Regina Club in Istanbul. What are the photos we're being shown? Shoes. Here's another alleged attack in Turkey. Shoe. Here, another one. Another one. They're not the same events. Please understand that. These come from different terror attacks. And here we have the Ankara airport terror attack. Why on earth would you place a pair of trainers in the front of the image if they were not very important? It's taking up like one-fourth of the image, Nike trainers. Tunisia, the alleged terror attacks there. What are the photos that are being shared in international media? Shoes, shoes, shoes. And this was where this MP in England, he was in charge of that. Even in Iran, we have an alleged shooting of a politician here. And what is left on the crime scene? A shoe. Pakistan. I mean, is this getting boring for you? Because it's very repetitive. But then again, please see what is going on here. The alleged terror attacks, the alleged suicide bombers, the alleged all of these things. But as part of the operation, this is what we're being shown. And here we have an alleged mass shooting, which was an incredible shooting. It was in Peshawar at a school. You got a major shoe there as well. And at this shooting, it was very different from other shootings, because here on BBC and many other photos from the event, there were photos of Noah Posner, a young boy, 6 years old, that was said to have been killed in Sandy Hook 2 years earlier. And you can see it's the same photo. Even his father has been confronted with this, asking him, how could your son reappear and get killed yet again 2 years later, almost on the day, but this time in Peshawar, Pakistan? And when you look at the official crime photos, you have all of this horrific stuff, blood, 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 and what is in the center of the image? Shoes. Yemen. How surprising. Shoes, 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 shoes. All of these alleged suicide attacks leaving shoes. Syria. Agony of victims. The shoes again. School bombings, suicide bombers. They show the shoes. Nike shoes once again. Here, they're also from a nursery. They said that they blew up a nursery. What do we see here? Bloodstains and shoes. And please notice that the color of the blood is extremely red, even though it's said to be hours and hours after these alleged events, that the blood is still this very, very powerful red, which is not normal. I mean, blood very quickly goes into a brown, rusty type of color, depending, of course, from where in the body it comes from and the amount of oxygen and so on. But it oxidizes very, very quickly. And here, more in Syria, also a photo propaganda thing about against Assad with the shoes right on top of this photo. Nepal, of all places, there was a cathedral bombing there. And so, of course, what images would you use? A shoe. Russia. Here's an alleged plane crash in Russia. So what do you take photos of? The plane, I would suggest, would be a good idea. No, the shoe. Somalia. Here we come. How surprising indeed. Here we go to Palestine, Israel. So here is a pizzeria blown up in Israel or Palestine. So what do we see? We see broken glass and a pair of shoes. We got more from Israel here. And when you look at these operations, I mean, the things that comes every single time when it comes to false flag terror, Mossad is there, CIA is there, working hand in hand, being in bed together, sometimes MI6, sometimes also using the intelligence agencies in whatever country they're carrying it out. And sometimes they use agencies from the neighboring countries that will then carry out the operation, but will not be easily identified as would local agencies, because you never use the people from the same country, because they could be identified by coincidence and so on. So you always use from other countries. Here, also a Palestinian so-called terrorist is being arrested here. What have we got in the middle of the photo? The shoe. Shoes, shoes, shoes. So the Bali bombing 2002, what's there? The shoe. How come the FBI was there almost before the local police even came to the site? It was a massive, massive two explosions, the Sari Club and the Paddy Bar. I've recently been on location and checking it out. It's an incredible thing. The year after 9/11, getting Indonesia and Australia into the war of terror. And the memorial images and so on. What are we looking at? Shoes. Thailand. How surprising. We got shoes again. Look at the way they're placed. Is that what it looks like if a bomb has exploded or something like that? Would you place the shoes like that? And often it's not a pair of shoes, like somebody has been killed. There would be two shoes. But most of the time it's just one shoe. And here on the equipment, when the police comes to the site in Thailand checking out the bomb site, it says on the equipment, FBI. So I would ask, what is FBI doing in all of these countries? Because they are there, I tell you. I thought FBI was supposed to be in the US only. Not anymore. Kenya, Africa. And so terror attacks, suicide bombers, what are we looking at? Shoes. University shootings, supermarket shootings. Nigeria, here we come. Shoes. More shoes from Nigeria. Afghanistan, I mean, come on, you must be kidding me. More shoes of alleged terror attacks. Afghanistan is one country that has been hit very, very badly. But they use these images, like the top left one. That is not about a terrorist attack. It's about a murder of a local politician. But what do they take of the photos of the crime scene, of the body? No, not at all. They use the shoe again. It continues. Shoes. Even in Canada and the US and everywhere. Let me just show you also the Boston bombing. The symbol of the whole thing of the Boston bombing is the shoe. So let me quickly show you from the Charlottesville's alleged car attack. This is the car that is said to have just crashed into the crowd and is leaving the site. And here, when the car leaves, what does it leave behind? A shoe. So who on earth have the power to coordinate all of these things? And also, recently, Benjamin Netanyahu, who is the master of terror, if you ask me, he invited the Japanese PM for dinner. And what was the dessert? It was served in a shoe, which I would say is the ultimate insult. And here you got like Nike shoes, even the blood spatter on some of their models. And they've even used it in their marketing. You may not survive the blast, but your shoes will. I mean, somebody needs to ask Nike what is going on. And while looking for all of these images, I came across this image. And when I clicked on it, guess where it's linked? I click on it, and where did it take me? The CIA's own website, CIA.gov. And I would say this is where all the dots get connected. So with that said, I want to thank you for your patience. I'm sorry if I was very repetitive, but I think there is a very clear pattern going on here. And I think the more we see these patterns and we start understanding what's going on and also exposing the forces behind them, then we can stop so much mayhem in this beautiful, beautiful world that is meant to be a paradise and is now turned into absolute hell for a lot of people.
You've been listening to investigative journalist and author Ole Damgaard on Find the Clues and Connect the Dots. From the Deep Truth, Visionary Speak Out online video conference produced by No Lies Radio. Next, we hear from author and radio host Kevin Barrett on Zionism, Psychopathy, and the Hijacked Provocation. Today's show, The Global Tour of Terror, A Theory of False Flag Operations. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
So I'm going to be talking about the theory of false flag terror a little bit. It's hard to study the issue of false flags because obviously the people involved in them are unwilling to divulge most of the information about them. It's only on a fairly rare number of occasions that people who have been involved in false flags will say anything at all about them. People like Robert David Steele, who actually ran a false flag for the CIA, is not allowed to say anything other than that he did that and that nobody died, but he can't go into the details. It's all still classified. So we're studying a subject that is 99% underwater, like an iceberg. We only see the tip. And to try to figure out what's going on, we have to connect the dots and work with inadequate information and all kinds of clues, as well as the, you know, the hard facts that do get reported that end up intellectually pointing towards the truth of these matters. So with that said, I'm going to say that the presentation I'm doing is on this new book by Laurent Guyonneau, From Yahweh to Zion. It's the culmination of his roughly decade study of false flags. And as a historian, I think that Laurent is in a very good position to study false flags, because journalists really have a hard time with false flags. They happen in real time. The journalists have to report in real time. And obviously, the people are not telling the truth about this. The information is not available for journalists. So it takes somebody like a historian who can piece together all of the evidence and the clues and ultimately often go back in time to see what has emerged about events in the past, who's more likely to be able to tell us how these things work, who actually is behind them, what they do precisely, what kinds of networks carry these out, how do they give orders to do things when this is all so top secret? Is there anything written? How does it get destroyed? All of this. So my presentation is focusing on three contributions that Laurent has made to the study of false flags. And these in the title, I'm listing Zionism, psychopathy, and the hijack provocation. We're going to start out with the last one, the hijack provocation, and work our way to the two earlier ones. So what is a hijack provocation? Well, before we get there, let's just introduce Laurent Guyonot. He is an engineer from the École Nationale Supérieure in Paris, and he earned his PhD a little later in medieval studies at the Sorbonne. He's written several books, some on medieval history, and his two most recent books take up the subject of false flags. JFK 9/11, published by Progressive Press a few years ago, and then From Yahweh to Zion, which I translated and published just a few months ago. In the book We Are Not Charlie Hebdo, which I edited a few years ago, Dr. Guyonot contributed a terrific chapter, which I think is really the one that gives us the theory of how these hijacked provocations work, how false flags sometimes are actually run as joint operations by more than one intelligence agency. And it may be that one intelligence agency is hijacking the operation from another one. And that seems to be what happened in the 2012 Mohamed Merah affair that Dr. Guyonot discusses in his contribution to We Are Not Charlie Hebdo. This event was essentially a two-part series of events, a little bit like Charlie Hebdo itself and many other of these events. Remember, in the Charlie Hebdo event, we had a bunch of cartoonists that killed allegedly by angry Muslim radicals. And then we had a shooting and kidnapping, hostage-taking event at a kosher deli, tying together the attack on the nation and on free speech, that's the cartoonists, and then the attack on Jewish targets or Israel, which was the attack on the kosher deli. The same thing happened earlier in 2012 with the Mohamed Merah affair. He was the patsy who was blamed for these two totally separate and actually in reality probably essentially unconnected violent episodes. The first thing was on March 11th. These tattooed guys wearing neo-Nazi tattoos, presumably French soldiers, shot three North African French soldiers in Montauban, France. And various indicators suggest that this was, in fact, a DCRI false flag, that is a French intelligence false flag designed to demonize the National Front, the Front National, which is the supposed extreme right neo-Nazi party, in order to help Sarkozy, who was about to go down. Sarkozy was in serious trouble in that election. The National Front was taking away the votes that he needed to win in the first round. And then suddenly there was this attack by apparent neo-Nazis, which demonized the National Front and actually helped Sarkozy survive in the first round. So that was the March 11th shooting. And then March 15th, another one, which helps make it even more of a publicity thing. And then on March 19th, there was a totally separate shooting at a Jewish religious school in La Roserie. Four people were said to have been killed, but there's no evidence actually that they were. That is, no autopsies were allowed, and the victims' bodies were allegedly immediately taken to a plane and flown to Israel to be buried as national heroes. But Laurent thinks that very likely there was actually no real shooting there. Then on March 21st, Mohamed Merah, who probably had nothing to do with either event, but who was a usual suspect, who was essentially a party-hardy guy. They told us he was a radical Muslim, but he wasn't. He was not religious in the least, and he was working for the intelligence services, and therefore they were able to manipulate him, and he was set up and executed in a dramatic night-long event. He was actually killed in the evening, and then they pretended that he was still alive and kept firing shots all night, and made up a false story about him leaping through a window and so on. So it was a huge television spectacular. So the hypothesis is, according to Laurent Guyonot, that the Israeli Mossad was able to seize upon this first series of shootings of the French soldiers, the Montauban affair, and then they created a fake shooting at the Jewish school and then claimed that the same guy did it. And this, of course, hijacks the whole thing to use for pro-Israel publicity, sending the message to the public that those who protest the war in Afghanistan and the coming war in Iran are killers of Jewish children. And then it also left French intelligence, the DSGI, vulnerable to blackmail because they had, of course, been involved in the Montauban operation. So now they're forced to go along with the Mossad agenda because the Mossad has the goods on them. So this is a hijacked provocation. That is a false flag started by one intelligence service and its assets and then hijacked by another one and perhaps actually magnified by another one. Could this explain any of the major false flags that we've seen? Well, Laurent Guyonneau says, yes, the two big ones, JFK and 9/11. This is Jack Ruby on the right, or Jacob Rubenstein, who was a hired killer for Mickey Cohen, the Jewish gangster who ran the West Coast for the Meyer-Lansky Syndicate at the time, and who on live television walked into the Dallas Police Department and killed Lee Harvey Oswald, the patsy or alleged lone assassin. According to Laurent Guyonneau, Gary Ween may be right. Now, how many JFK researchers have even heard of Gary Ween? Not a whole lot. But Ween actually may be barking up the right tree, according to Laurent Guyonneau, and suggesting that, in fact, he got this straight from Senator John Tower, that this JFK assassination was, in fact, what Tower called a double cross of fantastic dimensions, in which a fake assassination attempt staged by Howard Hunt and the CIA originally, and there's a lot of evidence to support this, that the first plans for the Dallas coup involved creating a fake assassination attempt against Kennedy to be blamed on the Cubans to trigger war in Cuba, which Kennedy had been leaning against, but this would have inflamed the country and forced a war on Cuba. So that's the CIA original attempt on Kennedy. It was supposed to be a fake assassination. And then, according to Gary Ween's information, as well as other information, what Ween calls the Russian Jewish Mafia, which is essentially Meyer Lansky's mob, which is essentially organized crime, the biggest organized crime syndicate in the world and in the United States at that time, moved in and took it over and actually killed the president. But, of course, behind this mishpucha, or the so-called Russian Jewish mob and Meyer Lansky, of course, we have the Israeli Mossad, David Ben-Gurion, who had just resigned in outrage over Kennedy's insistence that Israel would never get nuclear weapons. And, of course, the CIA Mossad infiltrator, James Jesus Angleton, was likely a major orchestrator of the Kennedy assassination as well. So, again, we have a possibility of a hijacked provocation with 9/11. As we had, according to Laurent Guyonneau, perhaps a U.S. deep state plan for a more limited false flag attack, perhaps just at the Pentagon, maybe plane crashes at the Twin Towers, who knows, but something that was aimed at justifying the invasion of Afghanistan. But this then may have been taken over by the infiltrated Zionist network, whose goal was much more ambitious. This was from Yahweh to Zion, and again, Laurent Guyonneau points out that the many players involved in 9/11 will essentially all have blackmail material on each other and be able to silence any who would otherwise get out of line. And that means that if indeed it were a more limited operation, in the same way that the JFK assassination may originally have been planned to be just a fake assassination attempt, here, if it were a more limited false flag that was suddenly turned into a massively murderous one with nearly 3,000 people dead, that those who had planned the more limited one would be in no position to expose the murderous, the massively murderous one. And there's some evidence to suggest that Guyonneau could be right about this. According to Susan Lindauer, who worked for the CIA Iraq desk, she was handled by her case officer, Richard Fuse. They both knew, Richard Fuse learned and told Susan, that a huge terror attack was coming to Manhattan. Something big was coming to Manhattan anyway in late August, early September. And then on the morning of 9/11, Susan Lindauer was on the phone with her CIA case officer, Richard Fuse, and together they watched the Twin Towers burning and then suddenly exploding. And according to Susan Lindauer, Richard Fuse's reaction was this anguished scream, "The goddamn Israelis." This is one, you know, one piece of evidence that would go along with Lauren Guillenot's hijacked provocation hypothesis. That is that people in the CIA, like Fuse, knew something was planned. It was an inside job in that sense that the U.S. command chain was in on it, but that perhaps the murder of 3,000 people was a little more than they had realized was going to happen. There's all sorts of evidence that Israel was behind what happened at the Twin Towers. So another piece of evidence suggesting that 9/11 may have been this kind of hijack provocation is the testimony from people on board Air Force One that essentially they were targeted by somebody on the inside who had the code name for Air Force One, that was Angel, was threatening to shoot George W. Bush out of the skies after his plane took off from the elementary school in Florida. And so this means that there was a coup d'etat-style attack from one rogue network within the government against the rest of the government, as Webster Tarpley has pointed out in his work. And Bush, while on Air Force One, here he is on Air Force One on September 11th, he begged to return to Washington and take command, and Cheney refused the president's direct order, telling you who was actually acting president on September 11th. This, of course, was an act of treason by Cheney. Bush was sent to Barksdale Air Force Base and then finally to Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska against Bush's own wishes. Something happened to him there at Offutt Air Force Base. We don't know what. Then he was flown back to Washington, and that night he did his hostage video TV thing and said America is at war, read his lines that he was ordered to read. So there was obviously a coup d'etat by one faction of the government against other factions. And again, this goes along with Lauren Guillenot's hijacked provocation hypothesis. So more details about this hijacking of Air Force One and the threats against Air Force One came out just a couple of years ago on 9/11/2016 from NBC News, of all places, that Bush was furious and virtually unable to communicate with the outside world. So that is the coup plotters had essentially gotten control of the president. And perhaps Cheney was on board with some of those Israeli coup plotters. So an overview of hijack provocations includes, in all of these examples that we've seen, and there are a few others as well, we have a Western intelligence agency scheduling some kind of illegal operation, whether it's French intelligence shooting a couple of its own soldiers as a favor to Sarkozy to help him get elected, or it's the CIA setting up what's supposed to originally be a fake assassination attempt on Kennedy, or it's the CIA or Bush and the U.S. people setting up some kind of limited false flag on 9/11. Then it's hijacked and massively magnified, and especially in the latter two cases, by Israeli intelligence in collusion with their network of Sayonim, which, of course, are the 100,000-plus Jewish people around the world who are willing to volunteer for Mossad. Many of these people are in the very highest positions of power in countries all over the world. And then elements of organized crime, which is also largely dominated by people who are ethnically Jewish and who have a loyalty to the state of Israel. So the result is that the false flag is turned to serve Israel's interest. And those who know what happened, like Richard Fuse, the CIA case officer who knew something that was coming on 9/11, and then who realized what Israel did afterwards, have already been implicated, then they have to stay silent. And then Richard Fuse also got, I think it was something like $10 million in hush money after 9/11, which he used to build a mansion near Washington, D.C., as Susan Lindauer has described. If you want a kind of a sketch of how this is done, check out John le Carré's book, The Little Drummer Girl. It's ostensibly a novel, but it's all based on information that John le Carré got from an inside Mossad source who describes precisely what the Mossad has been doing, how it runs rings around Western intelligence agencies in creating the theater of terror, that is false flag terror events. And another kind of hijacking is hijacking of truth movements. Lauren Guillenot argues that much of the 9/11 truth movement has knowingly or unknowingly been hijacked by Israel. The inside job phrase, he argues, is a catchphrase invented by Israel precisely to threaten the American government with massive destabilization if anybody in the American government ever tries to come forward with the truth about 9/11, which is that it was primarily an Israeli operation, then they're in a position to bring down the American house by having prepared this truth movement saying, inside job, inside job, inside job, it was the Americans that did it, the Americans that did it. Well, Guillenot argues that the major false flags in particular are disproportionately Zionist or Israeli. He points out that Israel has a long history and grand expertise in false flag terror, a world history of false flag operations. We need to dedicate at least half its pages to modern Israel, a nation less than half a century old. And I've listed some of the examples. Some of these false flags are admitted. The King David Hotel bombing, in which Mossad operatives or proto-Mossad operatives dressed up as Arabs blew up the King David Hotel. The Levant affair, in which Mossad operatives targeted Americans in Egypt and would have killed many Americans if, fortunately, things hadn't gone wrong for them. The Israeli government recently, not long ago, admitted that the Levant affair happened, that they did it, and then it gave honors and medals to the people who had planned to murder Americans in Egypt in a false flag attack. So how do we explain this Zionist preeminence in false flags? Lauren Guarino argues that this paranoid they want to kill us mentality is inculcated by Jewish scripture, that every year Jews celebrate the plagues of Egypt, the killing of the firstborn Egyptians. The book of Esther celebrates the murder of, I think, 70,000 Persians who were supposedly plotting against the Jews. There's this paranoid notion. They want to get us. They want to kill us. They want another Holocaust. That excuses everything that we do. So that essentially takes away all restraints, moral scruples, and leads to extreme behavior. Then there's the extreme difficulty of fewer than 15 million Jews invading, occupying, and genocidally taking over the Holy Land of 4 billion Christians and Muslims. Naturally, bold measures would be required for such a nearly impossible project. And then there's the International Sayanim Network and the envy of all other intelligence agencies. Hundreds of thousands of Jewish people around the world, many in the very highest positions, who are willing to volunteer free of charge to do anything for the Israeli Mossad. Then there's media dominance. Those who run the media decide which lies stand and which lies fall. And media in the Western world is heavily dominated by people who are ethnically Jewish with some degree of loyalty to Israel. They will never let out the truth about an Israeli false flag. They're inculcated to fear that terrible things will happen if they do. And finally, the domination of international organized crime and secret societies, banking and politics, again, by ethnically Jewish people, many, if not most of whom, have some degree of loyalty to the state of Israel. Finally, the psychopathy issue. Laurent Guyonneau, in his article, Israel, the Psychopathic Nation, takes up where Andrzej Lobosiewski left off in Political Ponerology, in which he argues whole nations can go psychopathic. Laurent argues that Israel has gone psychopathic in the same way that some communist countries did, according to Lobosiewski, perhaps Nazi Germany did, and so on. He argues that the Jewish nation as a state, but also as an organized world community, acts collectively towards other nations and other human communities in the way a psychopath acts towards his fellow men. Disclaimer, it goes without saying, he says, that I do not intend to imply that, quote unquote, the Jews are psychopaths, but instead that they are the first victims of a mental straitjacket imposed by their elites, who through the veritable intellectual terrorism make of them, to the extent that they comply, the instruments of the collective psychopathy of Israel. So this is collective psychopathy. It's not saying that individual Jewish people are psychopathic. Far from it. Israelis are always, and Zionists, and to some extent people who identify strongly tribally as Jewish, are always innocent victims. They see themselves as innocent, always innocent, no matter what they do. The other guy is always wrong. Everywhere we've gone, we've been persecuted and tormented and exterminated, and it's always been their fault. Well, this is exactly what psychopaths say. Martha Stout, one of the world's leading experts on psychopaths, says this is the first clue to a psychopath, is the other guy is always wrong. And then Israel's relationship to the United States, according to Guyonneau, is that of a typical psychopath who has influenced a powerful and impressionable man that he's going to use to accomplish his misdeeds. And Laurent compares this to Colonel House, the Zionist manipulator of President Wilson, who dragged the United States into World War I. Not all Zionist leaders are even willing members of this kind of psychopathic group contagion. Moshe Sharet was a very honorable, noble, and ethical Israeli leader. He was the foreign minister from 1948 to 1956, and then the prime minister, who was horrified by the methods of Ben-Gurion and other more mainstream Zionists who were dedicated to set the Middle East on fire and frighten the West into supporting Israel's aims by, quote, raising terrorism to the level of a sacred principle. That is precisely what Israel has done, and certainly never so much so as since 9/11. So why are people like Charette and other ethical Israeli leaders, and there have been some, why can't they overcome the psychopathic ideological power machine of Zionism? And finally, this is Laurent Guillenot's argument that he makes in From Yahweh to Zion, that this is rooted in the Bible. He says, in the final analysis, does not the Zionist manipulation go back to the creation by these ancient priests, the Levites, of a tribal god by the name of Yahweh, who has usurped the title of the creator of the universe and father of humanity? Ultimately, is not Zionism the logical outcome of Yahwism? And then he writes in this article, this is a question I will reserve for another article. Well, in fact, that article turned into a very, well, a moderately long book, 500 some pages, From Yahweh to Zion, which again, I translated from French and published a couple of months ago, earlier this year. So if you want to follow up on this and entertain this very provocative and, of course, controversial argument, I highly recommend reading From Yahweh to Zion. It got a very favorable, somewhat, including a disclaimer, but a very favorable review from John Cobb, who is probably the world's greatest liberal Christian theologian. And it's also gotten rave reviews from people like Gilad Atzman and others that you would expect to appreciate this material. It's a very fair-minded attempt to look at the so-called Jewish question throughout history and find out to what extent these issues are rooted in kind of a culture. It's not racist. It's not about biology. It's all about culture. And we are in a position where we do have to analyze cultural influences on political behavior if we want to understand what's really going on, and especially what's been really going on in the world since September 11th, 2001.
You've been listening to author and radio host Kevin Barrett on Zionism, Psychopathy, and the Hijacked Provocation. Today's show has been The Global Tour of Terror, A Theory of False Flag Operations. Kevin Barrett is an author, editor, and radio host of Truth Jihad Radio and False Flag Weekly News. Visit truthjihad.com and noliesradio.org. For more information on Oli Damagard's investigations of assassinations and false flag operations, visit lightonconspiracies.com. That's lightonconspiracies.com. To view the archived live stream of the Deep Truth Visionary Speak Out online video conference, visit noliesradio.org. That's noliesradio.org. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yara Mafo, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at G&B Radio.
Hey, yo, these are some serious times that we live in, G, and a new world order.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, a classic talk by historian Howard Zinn on war, government lies, and why the people need to know history. I hope you'll stay tuned. Howard Zinn was best known for his good book of 1980, A People's History of the United States. In the book, he looks at how history affects normal people, and how normal people helped create historical events. Conventional history books focus on the concerns of the powerful elites, and the book's aim is justifying the actions of the powerful elites. Zinn's book does otherwise. Zinn deeply believed that knowledge of history empowers the common people. That may explain why history courses in public schools are generally so boring and bad. The goal of public schools is to support the established power, not undercut it by empowering the common people. That's me speaking, not Zinn, but I don't think he would have disagreed. These themes come out in the talk we'll hear today. Zinn spoke at an anti-war teach-in in Boston on September 25, 2001. That's just 2 weeks after Saudi Arabians attacked and destroyed 3 buildings of the World Trade Center, according to the official narrative. Interestingly, the United States immediately began beating its war drums, not against Saudi Arabia, but against Afghanistan, which had fairly little connection to 9/11. Of course, Iraq had no connection whatsoever, and look where innocence got them. But I digress. So the WTC was attacked on September 11, Zinn spoke on September 25, and the U.S. launched its already planned invasion of Afghanistan on October 7, 12 days later. Zinn stresses the importance of knowing real history so as to inoculate ourselves against the lies of the powerful. Zinn makes 3 more key points. 1. Governments lie, especially in order to justify war. 2. Especially in wartime, checks and balances do not exist. And 3, you were not born yesterday. Don't let them treat you like you were. Unlike Howard Zinn, the U.S. war against Afghanistan seems to be immortal and permanent. Zinn died in January 2010. Here he is, still in his prime, on September 25, 2001.
You know, they, you know who they is? There's a they and a we, right? There's they and there's we. That's the world. And they want us to forget history. They want us to act as if we were born yesterday. Because if you forget history, if you were born yesterday, then you will believe anything. Anytime the president or any official gets up before the microphone and tells you, well, this is what happened and this is what we must do, well, if you have no history, if you have no memory, well, how can you check up? How can you know? You know, especially when from the time you were in grade school, you were ordered to stand up and pledge allegiance to the flag, right? You were disciplined right from the start and told to obey the rules and listen to the people in authority. notice the enormous move to obey the president. Did you see in the newspapers that, you know, our news commentators are objective people, right? You go to journalism school and they talk very seriously about objectivity, you know, report and so on and so forth. And then there are these anchor people. You know, what are they anchored to? You see, they're anchored to the establishment. That's why they're called anchor people, you see. And one of these anchor people, Dan Rather, was quoted, some of you may have seen this, was quoted as saying sometime last week, I saw this in the International Herald Tribune. This is one of those one-upmanship things, you know. Who reads the International Herald Tribune? I do. You see. I saw this in the International Herald Tribune. And Dan Rather was quoted on national television as saying, he's the president. When the president says, get in line, I get in line. Now, this, you know what I immediately thought of? Totalitarianism. Really, I thought that's what we used to say, you know, our leader has spoken. You know, get in line. You know, don't ask questions. You know, and our leaders are wise. What's encouraging is that there are people in this room and people in rallies and gatherings all over this country who are not getting in line. And that's very comforting for us. They want us to forget the history of governments and the history of our governments. I.F. Stone, some of you may have heard of, you know, one of the great journalists of the 20th century, I.F. Stone would be invited to speak to journalism classes, and he would say to these people who were going to be journalists, he said, look, if you really want to be a good journalist, you just have to remember two words. Governments lie, you see. And that is a fact. I mean, not just our government, but governments lie. Does this sound like an anarchist statement? You see? And, you know, anarchism is a philosophy. Anarchism isn't a bunch of hoodlums going around. That's not anarchism. That's the government, you see. But the anarchist philosophers, and I'm not talking about those few anarchists who decided to imitate the government and throw a bomb here or there, assassinate. No, the anarchists in general, anarchists as a philosophical group of as organizers, you know, Emma Goldman and Peter Kropotkin and Alexander Berkman, you know, they understood the nature of governments. And the nature of governments is to lie. Well, for a very simple reason. Because if governments told the truth, they wouldn't be in power very long, you see. And so it's very, very important to know the history of governments. Very important to know the history of American governments, right? And to think of how, especially in wartime, and there's something about wartime that brings out prevarication. Lies. But, you know, I've never used the word prevarication publicly. I thought I would try it out tonight. You see. There's something about war that brings it out, you know. And so, you know, the Mexican War. I know all of you remember the Mexican War. I mean, how do you think we got Texas and Colorado and Arizona and New Mexico and California? Because the Mexicans liked us and gave it to us. They're kind people. They have that Latin generosity, you see. But it was in the Mexican War that we acquired that territory, roughly half of Mexico, and we thought the Mexicans should be grateful. We didn't take all of Mexico, you see. But the Mexican War started with a lie. You know? Oh, wow. There's always an incident and a lie. And so there was this incident on the border, you know, the Texas-Mexican border between the Nueces River and the Rio Grande River, and American troops go into this disputed territory. There's a clash. People are killed. And the president, I started to say, goes before the microphone, but I guess, no, they didn't have that. President Polk announces to the country that American blood has been shed on American soil. I mean, later, many, many years later, when I heard President Bush, the elder, say, you know, they've insulted an American soldier in Panama. What are we going to do about it? Oh, no, actually, an American soldier's wife, because I forgot, he's a feminist. And this must not be allowed, you see. But, you know, they've... American blood has been shed on American soil, and soon, you know, the armies are there on their way to Mexico City. You know, and soon we have, as I say, half of Mexico. Lies. 1898, the battleship Maine is sunk in Havana Harbor. By the way, nobody asks, when they discuss, and they always, this always comes, there's one thing you learn about American history. You learn about the battleship Maine. There's about seven things you learn about in American history. And one is the sinking of the Maine and how that led to the Spanish-American War. And in none of the textbooks that deal with it, and none of the classes that deal with it, it's only none of the classes that I ever attended that dealt with American history, does anybody ask the question, what was the battleship Maine doing in Havana Harbor? You know, it's like when the American destroyer was attacked, right? In Yemen, right? I didn't see any newscasters ask, what was an American destroyer doing way, way out there? You know, it's like the Gulf of, you know, and, you know, when the Gulf of Tonkin incident took place in 1964, you know, oh, wow, they've attacked American destroyers in the Gulf of Tonkin. Where is the Gulf of Tonkin? You know, it's, I guess it must be off the coast of San Francisco. Because maybe if you really showed a map and showed where the Gulf of Tonkin is, you might ask, what were American destroyers doing off the coast of Vietnam, so far from home, you see? But lies were told about that. And the lies that were told about that led immediately to Congress passing resolutions giving... Does that sound familiar? Congress passing resolutions giving the president full power to do whatever he wants to do in the Gulf of Tonkin, leading to a 10-year war in Vietnam which cost several million lives. Another lesson from history. Don't trust Congress. Don't believe in checks and balances, that stuff that you got in junior high school. Oh, what a wonderful system we have. One branch will check the other branch, you know, and that way nothing bad can happen, you see. No. In time of war, Congress is always a flock of sheep, you see, and so is the Supreme Court. You know, the Supreme Court doesn't fool around with war, however unconstitutional the war is. Whatever rights are being taken away by the war, the Supreme Court will not defend those constitutional rights. Well, Anthony mentioned Debs. You know, the Supreme Court voted unanimously that Debs should go to jail for speaking out against the war. Hey, what about the First Amendment? Like, the members of the Supreme Court never read the First Amendment to the Constitution. Doesn't matter. It's time of war. Time of war, we all become yes men, all of them. The Congress, the Supreme Court. And so, you know, there you have, just as happened last week, you know, Congress at the time of the Gulf of Tin voting almost unanimously in the House, almost unanimously in the Senate, almost two dissenting votes by Senators Wayne Morse and Gruening. If people knew some history and heard about this near unanimous vote, the one heroic vote against it by the African-American congresswoman from California, Barbara Lee. If people knew some history, if the teachers gave them history, if the media gave people a little history, if anybody with power over our communications network gave people some history, they might recognize in this rush of Congress towards war, they might recognize that same subservience that Congress has always shown when it comes to matters of war. So history can be useful. History can come in handy to tell you something about governments, to tell you something about the structure of governments, to tell you something about deceptions and lies. Because if people knew that history, they wouldn't simply sit back and listen to Bush and sort of be impressed by the fact that he knows how to read, you see. The media, too. I mean, you think in a democratic country there'd be... And I remember when I was taking courses in political science, when I foolishly took courses in political science, they would talk about, very soberly, seriously, about pluralism, American pluralism, you know, all the different divergent ideas and so on in the United States. But in times of crisis, there's no pluralism. There's one voice. And so when Bush gives that speech, as he did last week, everybody, all of the media, and all of the television experts rushing before the camera saying, what a beautiful speech. Did you notice his face? Did you notice, you know, the way he timed his words? None of them had anything to say about the substance of his speech, because that's not important, because it doesn't matter what the substance is. We'll do what he says, you see. We must learn something about the history of governments and the history of the relationship of people to governments. And must learn something about what democracy is. Democracy is not falling in line behind the president. Democracy is for people to think independently, to be skeptical of government, to check up for themselves, to look around and try to find out what's going on. And then, if they see that the government is deceiving them, to speak out as loudly as they can. That's democracy. Well, Anthony was giving you some of the history of American foreign policy, particularly with regard to Iraq. But that's a history that needs to be recalled. I'm not going to recall it all for you. It would take a while, because our foreign policy has been very full. You know, we're not Switzerland, you see. We are a great power. A great power has a lot of foreign policy, most of it bad. You see. But that the history of our foreign policy is very important, because without it, we will not understand how much animosity we have engendered in various parts of the world, not just in the Middle East, but elsewhere. We won't be able to understand that. If we don't have any history, we will live our lives with the kind of things we were taught in elementary school, that the United States is a force for democracy and liberty in the world. And we have been the Boy Scouts of the world, you know, helping countries across the street, you know. And, you know. But to study the history of American foreign policy is to study the history of an imperial power, a power that took over from the British Empire and the French and the German and the Russian and the Dutch empires, and it established the most powerful empire of all after World War II. And it sent its troops all over the world and sent its ships all over the seas and intervened again and again in places so far from home, nobody could talk about it as being defensive. And in its foreign policy, consigned several million people to their deaths. And in this foreign policy, supported terrorist governments in various parts of the world, especially in Central America, especially in the Middle East. So the history of American foreign policy is a very important thing to know. And I'm stressing all this because I think that we all need to become communicators of this history. Because since the public is not getting the history in the schools, the public is not getting the history from television or from the newspapers, it then becomes the job of informed citizens to do the kind of education that is lacking in the major media and in the culture. Because, and here's what I found, that as soon as people get a little of this history, it makes sense to them. They recognize it. Now, all this stuff about, 90% of the American people support Bush, sure. You know, because their memories have been wiped out, because they're treated as if they were born yesterday. And I have found in talking to people, and I think it's important to keep in mind, that as soon as you begin telling people a little bit, reminding people a little bit, hey, remember Vietnam? Hey, remember the Gulf War and all the hoopla and the yellow ribbons and so on? And now, all these people in Iraq are dead as a result of our pop. No? Remember, as soon as people learn, think a little, and learn a little history, as soon as you tell them something about the history of terrorism, and you point out to them all the times that terrorist acts have been committed and what has happened when governments have used force to say, we are going to stamp out terrorism, just as in this case. And then there's more terrorism. And then there's more force. And, of course, the force isn't called terrorism, but it is. Because any time you use violence indiscriminately and kill innocent people, you are engaging in terrorism. You see? So we have to broaden our definition of terrorism. And we have to think that this awful thing that happened on September 11th, yes, we need to feel deeply about that and feel for the victims of that and feel for the families of that, but we also need to learn from it. And we all need also to, when we remember the scenes of the people racing in shock from those fires, and the scenes of people crushed under the weight of the buildings, we ought to remember that these are scenes that have taken place in various parts of the world for a long time, and that therefore we need to see terrorism as an international phenomenon. The United States is not the only victim, and American citizens are not the only victims of terrorism. Because if we are going to have one world, if we are really, you know, considering the people talk about globalization and free flow of markets and free markets, but they don't talk about international solidarity of people. They don't say that we should consider people everywhere in the world as our brothers and sisters, that we should see the children all over the world as our children, and therefore we mustn't bomb these places. We mustn't invade these places. We mustn't use military force because this is all one human family and we must not do damage to any members, you know, of this family. This is, you know, just one more thing about remembering and not being born yesterday. Let's remember that the American people, Lincoln was right. You can fool some of the people all the time, all of the people some of the time, but not all of the people all of the time. Remember? And Lincoln, and he's right, because if people do wake up, people do learn, people do come to their senses after that first wave of, oh, support the government, people do look around, and their common sense and their common humanity tells them, and we've seen this in the past, tells them something is wrong here. People woke up to what was happening to black people in the South at a certain point. And then whites joined the movement, and it became a national movement. People learned after a while what was happening, what we were doing to people in Vietnam, and they woke up and we had a great national movement. So never think because of the polls, or never think because of the huzzas for the president that come from the press and the anchors. You know, never think that they are going to have it their way and the people will be fooled all of the time. We've seen movements grow from groups of people like this gathered all over the country to great national movements. We need another one today, and we may be on the way to one. Thank you.
Howard Zinn, speaking in Boston in 2001 on lies, war, and history. That recording, courtesy of radio program Unwelcome Guests. Unwelcomeguests.net. Not to be confused with newworldnotes.blogspot.com, which is us. Rather, which is we. From darkest Connecticut, we are Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, advising illegitimi non carborundum, reminding you that war is not healthy for children and other living things, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Peace.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. On today's show, you'll hear the second part of a speech given by Canadian foreign policy analyst Stephen Gowans, discussing his new book, Washington's Long War on Syria. And that'll be followed by some information on Google censorship. I know that many of the listeners know that what we've been told about 9/11 is a total fabrication. And it's important to keep in mind that the event of 9/11 is what has been used to allow the government to falsely justify its attacks on Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and Syria through its bogus global war on terror. While pretending to resist al-Qaeda and ISIS, it has been well documented that the U.S. and its allies are actually funding, supporting, and arming these proxy armies. And to get us started with today's show, I'm going to share with you first the two-minute segment by General Wesley Clark talking about his visit to the Pentagon right after 9/11. Stephen Gowans references Wesley Clark's statements right at the beginning of this part of his speech. So here's General Wesley Clark.
About 10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the joint staff who had used to work for me. And one of the generals called me and he said, "Sir, you got to come in. You got to come in and talk to me a second." I said, "Well, you're too busy." He said, No. He says, "We've made the decision. We're going to war with Iraq." This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, "We're going to war with Iraq. Why?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "I guess they don't know what else to do." So I said, "Well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to al-Qaeda?" He said, No. He says, "There's nothing new that way. They just made the decision to go to war with Iraq." He said, "I guess it's like we don't know what to do about terrorists, but we've got a good military and we can take down governments." And he said, "I guess if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem has to look like a nail." So I came back to see him a few weeks later. And by that time, we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, "Are we still going to war with Iraq?" And he said, "Oh, it's worse than that." He said, he reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper, and he said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office today. And he said, "This is a memo that describes how we're going to take out seven countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran."
And now, here's Stephen Gowans.
Let's jump to 2001. The aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, the retired U.S. Army General Wesley Clark told a reporter that during a trip to the Pentagon, he learned of plans the Pentagon had developed to attack a number of countries in the Arab and Muslim worlds. One was Iraq, which was soon attacked. Another was Libya, which was eventually attacked. And a third was Syria. In 2002, Syria was added to the Bush administration's Axis of Evil hit list, this regime hit list. Washington claimed that Syria was developing weapons of mass destruction and sponsoring terrorism. This was the same bogus charge it had leveled against Iraq as a pretext to topple the Arab nationalist government in Baghdad and to privatize an Iraqi economy, which Washington denounced as socialist and was indeed, to a large degree, publicly owned and planned. Iraq had combined its oil wealth with public ownership and planning of the economy to produce what one former U.S. State Department official had called the Golden Age. He wrote, "Schools, universities, hospitals, factories, theaters, museums proliferated. employment became so universal that a labor shortage developed. The same former U.S. State Department official wrote about Gaddafi in Libya, that by combining Libya's oil wealth with public ownership and planning of the economy, Gaddafi had enabled Libyans to, quote, live beyond the dreams of their fathers and grandfathers. In 2003, this is not widely known, but it is certainly not concealed on the public record, but in 2003, following the U.S.-British invasion of Iraq, the United States contemplated extending military operations in Iraq to Syria, but decided that its hands were filled with the pacification of Afghanistan and the difficulties it was encountering in the resistance in Iraq, and that it would have to achieve its regime change goals for Syria by other means. The first alternative to direct military intervention was to impose broad-ranging sanctions on Syria to do what sanctions are always intended to do, destroy economies. Destroy economies in order to make life so miserable for ordinary people that they rise up and overthrow their government. In a country as large as the United States, which has such an enormous impact on the global economy, is able to destroy the economies of small countries like Syria. Sanctions are also useful for propaganda purposes, because once you've destroyed a country's economy, you can attribute its economic difficulties to its failure to follow your economic policy prescriptions. To say, if you had adopted free trade, free markets, free enterprise, you would have been a prosperous economy, but you didn't do so. That's why your economy is suffering, of course, without mentioning the devastating impacts of sanctions. The sanctions, as intended, devastated Syria. In October 2011, the New York Times reported that the Syrian economy, quote, was buckling under the pressure of sanctions by the West. By the spring of 2012, sanctions-induced financial hemorrhaging had, quote, forced Syrian officials to stop providing education, healthcare, and other essential services in some parts of Syria. By 2016, according to a leaked internal UN report, U.S. and EU sanctions on Syria were causing huge suffering among ordinary people and preventing the delivery of humanitarian aid. The veteran foreign affairs correspondent Patrick Coburn, who writes for The Independent, likened the sanctions imposed on Syria to sanctions that had been imposed on Iraq from the early 1990s to 2003. Those sanctions, according to a UN estimate, had led to the deaths through malnutrition and disease of at least 500,000 children. More deaths than had been produced by all the weapons of mass destruction in history. As a result, two political scientists, John and Carl Mueller, had called the sanctions of mass destruction, more devastating than the atomic bombs that had been dropped on Nagasaki and Hiroshima, more devastating than all the mustard gas used in the First World War. In effect, the United States had taken measures equivalent to dropping two atomic bombs on Iraq. Largely unrecognized is that sanctions of this caliber have been destroying Syria for the last 14 years. You know, we see attacks carried out by Washington's proxy guerrilla armies. We see the beheadings, we see the eviscerations, we see the barbecuing of heads, we see the suicide bombings, but what we don't see are the invisible but equally, if not more, destructive effects of sanctions. Significantly, the moment sanctions were lifted on a defeated Arab nationalist Iraq in 2003, they were immediately imposed on an unbowed Arab nationalist Syria. Which means that from the early 1990s to 2017, for the last quarter century, the United States and its allies have waged a highly destructive campaign of economic warfare, the commercial equivalent of a nuclear attack, first on Iraq, subsequently on Syria. And why? Why have they done this? Because they're opposed to the Arab nationalist efforts to bring the economies of the Arab world under the control of people who live and work in the Arab world. Well, sanctions constituted the first means by which regime change was to be brought about. The second was to ignite or reignite the Islamist war on the Syrian state. The Islamist war that had been more or less quelled by 1982, But in 2006, Syria's Muslim Brotherhood had at least two meetings at the White House, according to the Wall Street Journal. In 2007, the Muslim Brotherhood helped found the National Salvation Front. The front met frequently with the U.S. State Department, with the National Security Council, as well as with the U.S. government-funded Middle East Partnership Initiative. In late 2010, just a few months, in fact, December 2010, just a few months before riots were to erupt in the Syrian city of Dara, marking the beginning of what would become known as the Arab Spring in Syria, the Muslim Brotherhood voiced its hope for a civil revolt to oust Assad's so-called heretical government. Well, the hope that a civil revolt would soon erupt was realized only a few short months later, an outcome that the United States and Muslim Brotherhood had been working on since 2006. But in early 2011, before the uprising in Dara, this upheaval swept across the Arab world, all was quiet in Syria. And this perplexed Western news organizations. I mean, there were demonstrations in Tunisia. There were demonstrations in Egypt. There was an uprising in Libya, but not the slightest evidence of distemper in Syria. So the New York Times and Time magazine dispatched reporters to find out what made Syria different. And here's what they reported. They said all was quiet in Syria because the government had broad support. They said all was quiet in Syria because even critics concede that Assad is popular. They said all is quiet in Syria because Assad has, and this is Time magazine, has endeared himself to the population, especially youth, the segment of the population from which rebellion was expected to spring, if indeed rebellion materialized. They said all is quiet in Syria because attempts to organize protests against the government had failed. Syrians, they said, felt no compulsion to protest against their government. And you can confirm all of this yourself. It's quite easy to do. Just go to the Internet archives of the New York Times or Time magazine for the months January, February, March, and April 2011 and read the stories on Syria. Well, in mid-March 2011, riots broke out in Dara. They were violent. Some rioters carried arms. Buildings were burned. Vehicles were set fire to on the street. Even U.S. officials, according to the New York Times, quote, acknowledged that the demonstrations weren't peaceful and that some protesters were armed. In the mythology that would later develop about the origins of the post-2011 or post-2010 conflict, this became the protests were largely peaceful, which I guess is another way of saying they're violent, but a way of putting it so it seems like they're peaceful. Eventually, the modifier largely was dropped altogether so that the story became the demonstrations were peaceful. And you can hear many people tell you today with great certitude that the demonstrations were peaceful without offering the slightest evidence to show how it is that these were peaceful. A week after the outbreak of violence in Dara, Time reported that there do not appear to be widespread calls for the fall of the regime or the removal of the relatively popular president. Well, that clashes with the narrative, the mythology that would be subsequently developed. Over a month after the outbreak of violence and rioting in Dara, the New York Times' Anthony Shadid would report, quote, the protests fall short of popular upheaval of revolutions in Egypt and Tunisia. Significantly, Time magazine would report that Islam was playing a significant role in the protests. So, if you look back over the long war on Syria, what do you have? You have civil disturbances fomented by Islamists dating to the 1960s. You have an Islamist guerrilla warfare, or guerrilla war, dating to the 1970s, culminating in the violent takeover of Hama in 1982. You have Islamists meeting with the White House, with the State Department, with the National Security Council from 2006 after Washington decides or abandons plans for direct military intervention in Syria. And we have Islam, according to Time magazine, playing a prominent role in the protests, which are violent and involve arms. Consistent with this, in 2012, the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency, one of a number of intelligence agencies in the U.S. intelligence community, reveals that the insurgency is Islamist and led by the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the forerunner of ISIS. So you have indication after indication that the uprising was not a peaceful, secular movement for democracy, but a renewal of Syria's decades-long civil war between Islamists and secularists, egged on by the United States and U.S. allies. Indeed, the Defense Intelligence Agency said that the insurgents were supported by the West, that they were supported by the West's allies in the Gulf and by Turkey. There are a number of other reasons to conclude that the uprising had nothing whatever to do with the pursuit of a secular liberal democracy. First, the Swedish Institute of International Affairs had observed that virtually all the members of the various armed insurgents groups are Sunni Arabs. The fighting has largely been restricted to Sunni Arab areas, whereas areas inhabited by Alawis, Druze, and Christians are passive or supportive of the government. Defections from the state are almost 100% Sunni. Money, arms, and volunteers pour in from the Islamic states or from pro-Islamic organizations. And, this is the Institute, religion is the insurgent movement's most important common denominator. So if this rebellion was guided by secular, liberal, democratic goals, why are Alawis, Druze, and Christians not participating? Second, the Assad government amended the country's constitution in response to the uprising to allow multi-candidate presidential elections. It also suspended the security law, which is the Syrian equivalent of our War Measures Act. The security law had been invoked for a number of reasons, not least of which is that Syria remains officially at war with Israel, and Israel illegally occupies Syrian territory on the Golan Heights. These concessions, I mean, in the direction of liberal democracy, were immediately rejected by the insurgents and by their supporters. Instead, the insurgency heated up, despite the fact that Syria now more closely approximated the paradigm of multi-candidate or multi-party representative democracy favored by the West than virtually any other Arab country, and certainly more so than the allies or the Arab allies of the United States, which are all military and royal dictatorships. Third point, this is a tart observation made by Zbigniew Brzezinski, Jimmy Carter's national security advisor. He said, you know, we started helping the rebels, whoever they are, and they're certainly not fighting for democracy given their sponsorship, Qatar and Saudi Arabia. Well, he might have added, they're certainly not fighting for democracy given that their main sponsor is the United States, which promotes not democracy but U.S. business interests. The late Middle East specialist Patrick Seal wrote that the Syrian uprising should be seen as only the latest, if by far the most violent, episode in a long war between Islamists and Ba'athists, which dates back to the founding of the secular Ba'ath Arab Socialist Party in the 1940s. It's not inspired by liberal democratic goals. I mean, it's inspired on the part of the insurgents by Islamic goals, sectarian goals, and on the part of the United States by neo-colonial goals. At the same time, the veteran foreign affairs correspondent Patrick Coburn wrote not too long ago that Washington has always wanted to get rid of Assad, not since 2011 when Obama told Assad that he needed to step down, from 2000 when Assad became president. Just as Washington has always wanted to get rid of his father, who they viewed as an Arab communist. So, you know, the United States and sectarian Sunni political Islam formed an alliance of convenience to eliminate a common enemy from the Syrian state. But it should be emphasized, the enemy is not Assad. It's not Assad alone. I mean, the standard operating procedure of U.S. campaigns of regime change is to reduce government's Washington abhors to a single individual who can be demonized as a Hitler or branded a brutal dictator or an animal, as Trump calls Assad, or a moral disgrace, as Noam Chomsky calls Assad, and so on. But the enemy is not the individual. If Assad were to step down today and leave in his place a successor who also espoused Arab nationalist values, the war would continue. Indeed, when the Ba'ath Arab socialist Saddam was driven from power in Iraq, the military dictator Washington installed in Iraq, initially, Paul L. Bremer, what was his act number one? Act number one was de-Ba'athification of the state. That is, removing from the Iraqi state every secular Arab nationalist. Washington then effectively imposed a constitution on Iraq, which bars forever secular Arab nationalists from holding places in the Iraqi government or Iraqi state. So the objective of Washington's long war in Iraq was the de-Ba'athification of the Iraqi state. The objective of Washington's long war in Syria is the de-Ba'athification of the Syrian state. So let me close on this. So a year after, Muammar Gaddafi, inspired by the Arab nationalist goals of unity, freedom, and socialism, was removed from power by Islamists backed by NATO. The Wall Street Journal revealed, and this always happens, it seems, you know, about a year after some event, you can read in the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times what was really going on. The Wall Street Journal revealed that Western companies had, or oil companies had, agitated for Gaddafi's removal because he was driving hard bargains with Western oil companies and insisting that Libyans benefit from their own oil resources. The State Department complained that this was resource nationalism. Well, you know, U.S. oil companies believe that the petroleum resources of the Arab and Muslim world should be used for the enrichment of their shareholders. But there's a systemic reason for that. They're supposed to behave that way. In their view, the shareholders come first. These resources aren't to be used for the benefit of people who live in the region. Gaddafi had the very opposite view, and as a result, he was eliminated. So, a day before this book went to press, I read a short essay by a notable Canadian, Norman Bethune. The essay was titled Wounds. Bethune, for those of you who don't know, not everyone knows who Bethune was a skilled and innovative surgeon who is at the forefront of the struggle for public health care in Canada. But he's perhaps best known for participating in two wars in the late 1930s. The first was the Spanish Civil War. The second was the Second Sino-Japanese War. In the Second Sino-Japanese War, Bethune joined Mao's forces as a frontline surgeon in the resistance against Japanese efforts to colonize China. It was in China that Bethune wrote his essay. And his essay was a meditation on the causes of war in which he was entangled, which produced the wounds that he was called upon every day to operate on. And as I read the essay, it struck me that what Bethune was saying in a very few words was what I had struggled in a whole book to say. So I quickly asked my publisher if he could include a short quote from Wounds as the epigraph of the book, which he readily agreed to. So let me read you the epigraph. Our wars of aggression, wars for the conquest of colonies, just big business. Yes, would seem so, however much the perpetrators of such national crimes seek to hide their purpose under banners of high-sounding abstractions and ideals. Today, the high-sounding abstractions and ideals are expressed in the claim that the West has a moral obligation to act, that we have a responsibility to protect, that we cannot stand idly by, and so on. The most insightful part of Bethune's essay, in my view, is the last paragraph. So he wrote, "What do these enemies of the human race look like?" And he's referring to those who, in the hunt for profit, start the wars which create the wounds that he's called upon to heal. Do they wear on their foreheads a sign so they may be told, so they may be shunned and condemned as criminals? No. On the contrary, they are the respectable ones. They are the pillars of the state, they are the pillars of the church, they are the pillars of society. They support private and public charity out of the excess of their wealth. They endow institutions. In their private lives, they are kind and considerate. But there's one sign by which these gentlemen can be told. Threaten a reduction in their profits, and the beast in them awakens with a snarl. They become ruthless as savages, brutal as madmen, ruthless as executioners. And when you read in the Wall Street Journal that Western oil companies had complained to the U.S. State Department that something had to be done about the Arab nationalist Gaddafi, who threatened a reduction in their oil profits, it's hard not to think of the pillars of society and respectable people of whom Bethune wrote. Well, Bethune ended his essay with this: "Such an organization of human society as permits them to exist must be abolished." And the overarching theme of this book is this: Washington's long war in Syria can only be understood within the context of the organization of human society as permits these enemies of humanity to exist. Thank you.
And again, you were just listening to the final part of a recent speech given by author Stephen Gowans. His latest book is called Washington's Long War on Syria, published by Baraka Books. Stephen Gowans has a website called What's Left, and you can get to it by going to www.gowans.wordpress.com. So gowans.wordpress.com, and Gowans is spelled G-O-W-A-N-S. So gowans.wordpress.com. And now, let's take a brief look at Google censorship. Here's a short clip from RT that exposes it.
Well, Google announced changes to its algorithm search last April, aiming to combat so-called fake news and conspiracy theories. In a blog post, a company executive said the technology would change its search rankings to help surface more authoritative pages and demote low-quality content. But according to my next guest, some believe this new algorithm is doing more than filtering out fake news. Andre Demin, reporter for the World Socialist website, thank you so much for joining us today. So before the election, many on the right were complaining that conservative articles were not coming up on Google searches, and now we're hearing something similar from the other side of the aisle. So you believe that the website you work for in particular is being targeted?
Yes, and among a whole series of left-wing, progressive, and anti-war websites. We have found, using our research based on the Amazon Alexa search tool and ratings tool, that the rankings and traffic of many left-wing websites have plummeted after Google implemented a new search algorithm, which was announced in that blog post you referenced on April 25th. And that had a tremendous impact on the amount of traffic, according to a number of websites that we've spoken to, coming from Google to progressive websites and left-wing websites. And yes, the World Socialist website was certainly affected.
And in terms of the right or left, regardless of political affiliation, should Google be in the business of determining what's fake news? And is this an infringement of freedom of speech, or is this a way to really help to stop spreading misinformation all over the place?
Well, we think that Google has no business in deciding what political viewpoints can and cannot be presented to users. If a user searches any topic on a political question, he or she should have a wide range of viewpoints that are presented to them. But the vision that was outlined in the April 25th document explaining the changes to Google's algorithm is something completely different. It envisions Google becoming a censorship engine rather than a search engine, in which it has a whole series of internal guidelines with evaluators, which are a little more effectively than censors, who decide what is real and what is fake, what news should be presented and what news should not be presented. And the effect is that people's opinions, if they don't line up with the interests of Google, which is one of the most politically connected corporations on the planet, having given more in lobbying donations over the recent period than any other corporation, if they don't line up with the interests of Google, if they don't line up with the interests of the government, if they don't line up with the interests of the military and intelligence establishment, they will be censored. And the vision outlined in that document is entirely consistent with the statistics that we've seen.
So there's pretty serious censorship going on as the corporate media giants lose control of the message they're told to deliver. I hope you'll use other search engines, and we can only hope they're not involved in the censorship, too. And that concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
Exclusive highlights from the Poor People's Campaign Against Poverty, Racism, and Militarism in D.C. featuring who? The poor, the disenfranchised, the marginalized, we the people, the moral agenda, which has been guiding the last 40 days of actions, calls for major changes to address systemic racism, poverty, ecological devastation, the war economy, and our distorted moral narrative, including repeal of the 2017 federal tax law, implementation of federal and state living wage laws, universal single-payer health care, and clean water for all, with the Capitol behind him in a city fraught with partisan politics, the Reverend William Barber laid out his vision for the Poor People's Campaign in his very gravelly preacher's voice. The rally followed 40 days of protest and civil disobedience across the country, but Barber wanted the crowd to know that that day was not the end of anything. It was, in fact, the beginning of a moral uprising across America.
And even though the day marked 50 years since Resurrection City, when thousands camped out in the same place to decry the plight of the poor, Barber also made it clear that they were not there to celebrate an anniversary. This is not a commemoration of what happened 50 years ago, he said. This is a reenactment and a re-inauguration.
And now, highlights from the Poor People's Campaign.
And so today is about the people, because I think it's time for a revolution. Today, you are the founding members of the 21st Century Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. We gather today for a call to action. We gather here declaring it's time for a moral uprising all across America. This is not a commencement. This is a commencing. This is not the commemoration of what happened 50 years ago. This is the reenactment and the re-inauguration. Because you do not commemorate prophets and prophetic movements. You go where the blood, where they fell, and reach down in the blood and pick up the baton and carry it the next mile of the way. For 3 years, we've been laying a foundation from the bottom up, not the top down, because helicopter leadership will not save us. Today, from this stage, no person will speak at the podium by themselves. Today, because of the continuing reality of two Americas, one land, the land of the very few with extreme lot, and the other land of the many with the very little who suffer dots, daily ongoing stress syndrome of their lives and the attention violence by the political culture toward the poor. We are here. People are watching by live stream around the country and the world. We are here to call the nation to action, to get our marching orders. We are here to put a face on the facts of poverty. We are here of every race, every color, every creed, every income, every faith tradition, especially the poor, coming together, declaring that we must have a poor people's not march, a poor people not rally, but a poor people's campaign to save, to save not the Republican Party, to save not the Democratic Party, but to save the very heart and the soul of this nation. Don't get it twisted. We are not the left. We are not the right. We are not the conservative. We are not the liberal, because those phrases are too puny and too weak and too limited. No, this campaign is standing in the deep moral tradition, in the deep religious and moral traditions that have always been necessary throughout history in order to lift those at the bottom and save countries from destroying their own potential. We are in the same moral tradition of the prophets of Israel, who challenged kings and rulers to stop legislating evil. We are in the same moral tradition of Jesus, whose evangelical work was not being against gay people, but being against poverty. We are in the same moral tradition of the Apache and other indigenous spiritual people who taught us to care and not destroy and poison the air, water, and the land. We are in the same moral tradition of the abolitionists who knew if slavery was legal, it was still immoral and it had to be challenged. We are in the same moral tradition of the Reconstructionists who, after the Civil War, fought for equal protection under the law. We are in the same moral tradition as the social gospel movement, who looked at poverty and corporate greed and asked, what would Jesus do? We are in the same moral tradition of those who fought for labor unions and decent wages and 8-hour work days, even when they were killed and hung in places like Chicago. We are in the same moral tradition as Cesar Chavez and MLK and Rabbi Heschel and Fannie Lou Hamer and Swana Cheney and Goodman and Rosa Parks and Unitarian and Muslims like Malcolm and gay people and social justice activists like Bayard Rustin. We stand in the same moral tradition that have always fought to help this nation be a little more grounded in love, truth, and peace, and to come a little closer to being a more perfect union. This is who we are. Make no mistake, America, you've got to get a new lexicon for this. You won't be able to report this like you've normally reported it. We are black, we are white, we are brown, we are red, we are yellow, we are gay, we are straight, we are old, we are urban, we are rural, we are Jewish, we are Christian, we are Hindus, we are Muslim, we are people of faith, we are people not of faith, from Alaska to Alabama to the deep south in Mississippi to northern Maine, from California to the Carolinas, from the Midwest, from the Rust Belt to the Wheat Belt. We are the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for a moral revival, and we won't be silent anymore. And since folk want to quote scripture, in Ezekiel 22, the Bible says, your politicians are like wolves, prowling and killing and taking whatever they want. But something is worse. Your preachers cover up for the politician by pretending to have vision and special vision and say God said it, and God ain't said nothing. And because of this, extortion is rife, robbery is epidemic, the poor and the needy are abused, outsiders are kicked around, immigrants are mistreated with no access for justice. So God says, I'm looking for somebody to stand in the gap. Who will stand in the gap was the question 2,600 years ago, and it's the question right now. When there are 140 million poor people in this country and over 200,000 die every year from poverty, while 400 families make an average of $197,000 an hour, the gaps are real. When we see homelessness on the street, especially among our children and LGBT communities, the gaps are real. When voter suppression is targeted at black, brown, and poor people in ways like we haven't seen since the days of Jim Crow, And when voter suppression and gerrymandering and the refusal to fix the Voting Rights Act is happening right here in the Congress and in state capitals, and it hurts poor people and sick people, and when the people who use racist voter suppression, once they get power, use that power to hurt white people and black people and brown people, the gaps are real. When poor folk live in communities where by the millions they can buy unleaded gas and can't buy unleaded water. When America is the richest nation in the world, poor and working people, but we don't have health care for everybody. When Puerto Rico is left and thousands die. When in Alaska they drill in the native lands, and when in the Apache lands they poison the water, and when we don't have the health care we ought to have, the gaps are real. When a politician gets free health care just because they got elected, but then they don't want the people that elected them to have the same thing they have. And when far too many preachers are engaging in theological malpractice, and they will pray, P-R-A-Y, for politicians and president, but not say a word when those politicians and the president pray, P-R-E-Y, on the least of these, the needy and the children, the gaps. When they claim that they have Jesus agenda, but they don't do or say what Jesus said. When I was hungry, did you feed me? When I was a stranger, did you take me in? When we live in a country where some will justify caging not just children, but brown children like animals, and they will separate and snatch them from their parents, and separate and snatch children from health care, and separate and snatch children from food stamps, the gaps between justice and injustice are real. And so it is our calling, as long as we've got breath in our body, right now and right here, to stand in the gap. Is there anybody ready to stand? Until the cries of the poor are heard and things change, stand. Until the cries of the sick get everybody health care, stand. So we can save this nation from a spiritual, economic, and political death, stand. We must stand in the gap and speak truth. Stand in the gap and nonviolently go to jail if necessary. Stand in the gap and mobilize voters. Stand in the gap and build power among the poor. We must stand with love. We must stand with truth. We must stand with grace. We must stand until we restore or build the heart of this nation. And we must stand. This is no time to retreat. This is no time to cry. This is no time to be silent. This is no time to run away. We must stand and declare that we were born for such a time as this. Is there anybody willing to stand? Until every gap is closed, stand. Until America lives up to her promises, stand. Until we are one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Is there anybody willing to stand? Stand! 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 And when you've done all, stand!
Hallelujah! Hallelujah! Now here to speak about systemic racism is Amy Jo and Quincy Bloxman. Irasima Hernandez, Jimmy Hawkins.
West Virginia. Did you know that there are fewer voting rights today in 2018 than there were 50 years ago? Did you know that since 2010, 23 states have passed racist voter suppression laws? That's a shame. Did you know 6.1 million people cannot vote because of felony convictions, including one in 13 black adults? Did you know that we imprison and detain more people, especially poor people and people of color, than any other country in the world?
Yay!
Did you know that federal spending on immigration, deportations, and the border has increased from $2 billion to $17 billion in the past 40 years? Did you know that from just April 18th to May 31st of this year, Border Patrol has handed over 1,995 children to Health and Human Services?
Health and Human Services is currently holding 11,000 immigrant children.
Jersey! Therefore, we demand the immediate full restoration and expansion of the Voting Rights Act and an end to racist gerrymandering and redistricting. We demand early registration of 17 and 18-year-olds, automatic registration at the age of 18, early voting in every state, same-day registration, the enactment of Election Day as a holiday, and the right to vote for all currently and formerly incarcerated people. We demand to end mass incarceration and the continuing inequalities for people of color and poor white people within the criminal justice system. We demand that First Nations, Native Americans, Alaskan Native people retain their tribal recognition as nations, not races, to make claims to their sovereignty. We demand an immigration system that, instead of criminalizing people for trying to raise their families, keep families together and gives people a clear, just path to citizenship.
So my name is Iracema Hernandez. People call me Sima, but you can call me your sister. I stand here in solidarity with Kenya from California. She is the co-chair of California Poor People's Campaign. She could not be here, but she is watching. She is welcoming a new addition to her family. I'm here today to talk about what's being done to our families, to shine a light on the atrocities happening to our brothers and sisters crossing imaginary borders. I am a daughter of immigrants, migrant workers who crossed the border for a better life and said it was a life of bondage. We worked the tomato fields, apple, peach, and orange orchards. As a little girl, I remember picking tomatoes with my grandmother as a plane flew over us, dumping pesticides. I lived in the shadows in fear for my mother and my abuelos that they would be deported for much of my life. Separating families is a practice that has been done for a very long time to keep us in control and keep us scared. The capitalist system is deeply rooted in white supremacy. When our brothers and sisters are crossing imaginary borders, it's not because they want to. It is because they have to survive war-torn countries, economic and ecological devastation caused by capitalist and white supremacy ideology that bombs black and brown nations to exploit and profit from humanitarian crisis. We must learn from history to avoid repeating it. We must stop families from being separated before it happens, not after the fact when it's comfortable and convenient to talk about it. My brothers and sisters, we can all do something to help stop these atrocities by divesting from the system that contributes to this perpetual war economy. Take your money to credit unions and reevaluate your retirement and investment accounts. Use the capitalist system against it and break it. I was born in this country. I am a citizen, and still I lived in fear. I was born into bondage. We were all born into bondage. But we can change that right now. To the people employed by the federal government just doing their job, do not let the job get in the way of your humanity. We are breaking free from our chains. You are not powerless. You are powerful. Can I hear you? Are we powerful? Woo!
All right, folks, now it's time for our speakers who will address the issue of systemic poverty.
Say shame.
Yeah. Give it up!
In Rhode Island, these are a couple of the many things that we demand. We demand living wages starting with $15 an hour and the right to join and form unions. We demand fully funded social services and welfare programs for the poor. We demand an end to an anti-union and anti-workers' rights laws in the states. We demand the expansion of Medicare in every state and the protection of Medicare as well for single-payer universal health care for all. We demand relief from crushing household, student, and consumer debt. We declare jubilee. Yes, yes. We demand equity and the safety of all persons, regardless of race, ethnicity, immigration status, sexual orientation, or gender identity. We demand equal treatment and accessible housing, health care, public transportation services for all people, including people with disabilities. We demand and repeal of the 2017 tax law and a stop to cuts to CHIP, SNAP, Medicare, LIHEAP, public housing, and other needed services and programs.
All right. Now we got Labor getting ready to come up on the stage because Labor understands they can't just fight for the contract. They got to fight against racism and fight against ecological and fight for health care. It's all one fight.
Good afternoon, brothers and sisters. My name is Claude Cummings, Jr. I'm the Vice President of the Communication Works for America District 6. For far too long, greedy corporations have taken advantage of workers at every turn. Corporations such as Verizon and AT&T are zealously fighting to ban their employees from organizing for fair wages and better working conditions. Even worse, these corporate CEOs are outsourcing good-paying American jobs and using the tax break they got from Trump to tax plan to buy back stocks while refusing to pay their workers a living wage. Please join me in welcoming Sherita Bryant to the stage.
Good afternoon, brothers and sisters. Thank you for allowing me to talk to you about corporate greed. I'm a proud CWA member, activist, organizer, and most importantly, a worker at AT&T in Virginia. Before the passage of Trump's tax plan, our CEO, Randall Stephenson, made a false promise to invest in his workforce and create at least 7,000 new jobs. Instead, just like all other greedy corporations, AT&T took the $20 billion they received in tax breaks and laid off thousands of workers across the country, including my state, Virginia. They did not stop there. Encouraged by administration's backing of corporate billionaires, AT&T has increased its efforts to offshore thousands of well-paying American jobs to overseas nations with low wages and contracted workers. Unfortunately, this is just another example of greedy corporations and their CEOs taking advantage of dedicated workers. They do not care about families and communities being devastated by these decisions. We are not going to be silenced. We are here today to say enough is enough. Let us stop corporate greed and put people over profits. Within the last year alone, my local union has organized 3 strikes at Verizon, AT&T, and Frontier Communications to fight for our fair share. Workers are the backbone of this economy. When workers win, we all win. But we can only win if we join together, organize, and fight back. Brothers and sisters, I am here today to say to these corporations, we won't be silenced. We won't back down. We'll fight to the end. Stay strong. Power to the people. Thank you, and God bless.
I work at Ronald Reagan Airport. And for a cleaning company called MBS, it's Metropolitan Building Services. And the fight for better wages, health care, and other benefits, it wasn't easy. And we managed to win our contract. We've had our contract for a year. But there's still a fight going on because, like many of these people up here have said, money, you need money to survive. And dealing with what I went through in my life and with my family and seeing how my mom and dad and everybody had to struggle, it's not right. And I'm fighting not just for MBS. I'm fighting for the other workers at the airport, Huntley, Ulin, G2, and many others. And we all need your support. Just because you see us, don't assume that we're making X amount of dollars.
That's right.
Don't assume that we're just sitting up here and we're okay. You don't know our story unless you ask us our story. A lot of us are, many of the workers there, they're living paycheck to paycheck, and we shouldn't have to. So I ask everyone to support, no matter who it is, big, small, light or tall, I ask for your support. Because my mother used to tell me, if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for everything.
That's right, girl. That's right.
Be the change that you want to be. Thank
Amen.
You.
Amen.
Stand.
Amen.
Give it up for her. Give it up.
Brothers and sisters, my name's Mark Perrone, and I work for the members of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union. And all the workers out there in this world that want to organize in our retail and food industries that we represent. I stand here today to introduce to you a person with courage, a person that I am proud to stand here with. She's currently organizing her workplace and inspiring workers and co-workers to stand up for the better life that they deserve.
Give it up. Say, we fight together. Everybody put a fist in the air and say, solidarity. Forever. Say, if 140 million poor people and working poor people come together in America, we will change this country for the better. Solidarity. All right. And the reason we're doing this is because you cannot address poverty unless you address systemic racism, systemic poverty. And by the way, racism is not Roseanne Barr's words. Racism is when you pass policies that hurt black and brown people, when you take voting rights, when you hurt indigenous people, when you stack the courts with racist judges. That's racism. Poverty, ecological devastation, the war economy, and militarism. Those are the last two sections where people will come and we will get our charge, because we are going, as I said, like Martin Luther, to put this on the Capitol door to let them know if they think that all we're going to do is have one rally, they got another thought coming. This is just the beginning. And one day we're going to all call together all across this country and going to do what? Shut it down.
Highlights from the Poor People's Campaign Against Poverty, Racism, and Militarism in D.C. This is just the beginning. Representing the poor, the disenfranchised, the marginalized, we the people fighting for people's power. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org. ORG. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
You know what the Stonewall riots were about?
I never have read about it.
No, I don't know nothing about it.
The disorders began with a routine police raid on a homosexual bar, the Stonewall, on Christopher Street.
I think they thought the people would just go home or run, especially since they were gay people. They're not used to gay people standing up at all, especially in front of police. Gay history rap!
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Marriage equality proposals reach three high courts and a legislature. South Africa's Equality Court rejects a religious right to hate. And tracing Stonewall from riot to celebration. All that and more this week now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Monique Lukens.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending June 23rd, 2018. Marriage equality is on the march in several countries around the world. The Philippine Supreme Court began hearing oral arguments on a petition to open the civil institution to same-gender couples on June 19th. Jesus Nicardo Falcis III, who became a lawyer just 3 years ago, filed a petition. Two of the justices warned him about what one called this very dangerous case that will require a very intimate reading of the provisions of the Constitution. Falcis acknowledged that he was fighting a very powerful heteronormative culture by initiating the case. Controversial President Rodrigo Duterte has previously voiced his support for changing the law in the predominantly Roman Catholic Southeast Asian nation. But presidential spokesman Harry Roque told a press briefing late this week that the Supreme Court and the country are not yet ready for same-sex marriage, adding that it may still be too revolutionary. The government is expected to formally argue its opposition at the Supreme Court on June 26th. There is no time limit for the High Court to issue its decision, and some say it could literally take years.
Peru's Constitutional Court heard a case on June 20th filed by Oscar Ugarteche demanding the legal recognition of his marriage in 2010 to Mexican citizen Fidel Aroche. A lower court in the South American nation had rejected the case on a legal technicality. According to an English-translated report in El Comercio, the court has 30 days to issue a ruling.
And on June 21st, Cayman Islands lawyer Chantel Day and her partner Vicky Bowden-Bush, a nurse from Britain, filed a writ with the Grand Court challenging the government's decision to refuse their application to marry. Their lawyers argue that the laws of the Western Caribbean British Overseas Territory defining marriage as between one man and one woman violate a number of rights guaranteed under the Cayman's Constitution.
Marriage equality may come to gay and lesbian couples in the Czech Republic through legislation rather than the courts. Equality advocates are celebrating the announcement by the Czech government on June 22nd that it was supporting a bill to open civil marriage to same-gender couples. A cross-party collection of 46 lawmakers drafted the bill. An opposing bill sponsored by 37 lawmakers calls for a heterosexual's only definition of marriage to be enshrined in the country's constitution. The Eastern European nation has offered registered partnerships to same-gender couples since 2006. With the government's backing, it now seems poised to become the first former Soviet bloc country to grant all the rights of civil marriage to those couples. However, major parties have been struggling to create a fully functional government since last October's divisive elections, so it's uncertain exactly when Parliament might begin to actually debate the opposing marriage proposals.
In other news, South Africa's Equality Court has ruled that hate speech is not a protected religious right. It found Cape Town preacher Oscar Buchard of Calvary Hope Ministries in contempt of court for continuing to spew hateful anti-queer rhetoric in public pronouncements, on social media, and in widely distributed email messages. He had promised the South African Human Rights Commission in 2013 to stop distributing what it called derogatory and offensive statements following formal complaints lodged against him. Buchard has written that homosexuals are an abomination to God and should be locked up in cages. He's falsely claimed that 99% of pedophiles are homosexual. And after he read about the execution by the so-called Islamic State in Syria of 9 men and a boy for homosexuality, Buchard appealed to ISIS to come rid South Africa of the homosexual curse. South African culture is still catching up with the laws of the land, which ban sexual orientation-based bias in the Constitution and prohibit public comments that are hurtful, harmful, or promote hatred against gay people. Entrenched societal prejudices still prevail, however, and can be expressed violently, even in major cities, but especially in outlying townships. The Equality Court ordered Buchard to spend 30 days in jail, but suspended the sentence for 5 years. If he makes hateful comments about LGBTQ people in public again during that time, he could go straight to jail.
The World Health Organization has finally removed transgender people from its list of mental disorders. It announced on June 18th that what's generally called gender dysphoria is now characterized by a marked and persistent incongruence between an individual's experienced gender and the assigned sex. While evidence is now clear that it is not a mental disorder, the press release said, there remain significant health care needs that can best be met if what it called gender incongruence is reclassified as a sexual health condition. The statement says that the change was made, in part, to combat the stigma that transgender people face and to reduce barriers to care. Some trans activists, however, remain unhappy about what they consider to still be negative connotations about them in the new classification. Progress, even to this point, has been a long time coming. France was the first country to declassify gender dysphoria as a mental disorder 8 years ago. A few other countries have since followed. The European Parliament called on the WHO to declassify gender dysphoria as a mental disorder in 2011, and the American Psychiatric Association declassified it in 2012.
One day after the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights denounced the Trump administration's immigration policy of separating children from their parents who've illegally crossed the southern border as unconscionable, America's UN ambassador, Nikki Haley, announced that the U.S. was withdrawing from the world body's Human Rights Council. It's the first country ever to do so. She charged that the council was anti-Israel, a protector of human rights abusers, and a cesspool of political bias. LGBTQ groups joined the chorus of human rights organizations across the country to condemn the move. Ty Cobb of the Human Rights Campaign wrote that, in recent years, the UN Human Rights Council advanced a number of initiatives focused on LGBTQ human rights, including a 2016 decision establishing an independent expert on sexual orientation and gender identity. With this decision, the Trump-Pence administration is leaving a vacuum at the Human Rights Council that may well be filled by countries that have little or no commitment to universal human rights. Outright Action International released a statement saying in part that withdrawing from the council sends a message to other countries that it is acceptable to walk away from the system when it doesn't suit you to be there. Democratic National Committee Chair Tom Perez didn't pull any punches, criticizing the Trump administration for sending a signal to the world that we're too weak to lead and too cowardly to fight for our foundational values. Trump's withdrawal is especially disturbing given his persistent praise for despots and dictators with abysmal human rights records, not to mention his administration's cruel mistreatment of immigrant families seeking asylum.
But finally...
It's you.
It's me.
And you're Jewish.
Yeah. And I'm black, too. And gay.
That's the now award-winning kiss, generally cheered around the world. from the hit mainstream gay romantic coming-of-age comedy, Love, Simon. Exceptions include India, which banned the film on the day of its planned release earlier this month because of its depiction of gay relationships. But at the MTV Awards on June 16th in Santa Monica, California, the object of Simon's affection, Bram, played by out bisexual Australian actor Keon Lonsdale, was a clear audience favorite, especially because, as one fashion critic put it, the 26-year-old actor rocked a skirt and looked absolutely fabulous doing it.
And best kiss goes to
Love, Simon. Nick Robinson and Keon Lonsdale.
Wow. First of all, I know Nick really wishes he could be here because I know that he would be so grateful for this moment. I just want to say to every kid, you can live your dreams and wear dresses. You can live your dreams. You can live your dreams and kiss the one that you love, no matter what gender they are. You can live your dreams and you can believe in magic. You can live your dreams and you can be yourself. Thank you so much.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending June 23rd, 2018. Written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazer, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at the all-new thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Monique Lukens.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
Living up, living up, living up proud.
Was blamed by some on the recent death of Judy Garland, or maybe it was the sweltering New York City summer heat, or maybe it was the contagion of a civil rights movement instilling pride in the possibility of political power into long-oppressed minorities. But the world would never be the same after June 27, 1969. Aside from the chance to let their hair down, many people attending events celebrating the Stonewall Riots may not even be able to tell you why that uprising is a historic turning point worth celebrating. So This Way Out combed the rich audio archives at our disposal to assemble this LGBTQ Pride Primer.
My sweet Sherry. Hiding place over there, over there.
Before the last weekend of June in 1969, it was illegal in many U.S. cities to serve alcohol to homosexuals or for two men to dance together. Gay bars were often run by organized crime, drink prices were inflated, and police raids and subsequent public ruination were routine. All that changed when the queer patrons of the Stonewall Inn on Christopher Street in New York City's Greenwich Village finally had enough.
Strutting around like a heavy duty
mug.
Now I know we got to get up and we can sing it loud now. We can sing it loud now. We can sing it loud now.
Yeah, I'm proud.
Parades and festivals celebrating gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender pride are now held in cities all over the world practically all year round. But the tradition was born in June. Unfortunately, it's not surprising to discover that many people, even those who come out to enjoy the celebrations, don't know what event they're commemorating.
Do you know what the Stonewall Riots were about?
I never have read about it, what exactly happened there, and the purpose of it.
I've never heard anything about it. No, I don't know nothing about it.
So just what is this party all about? The significance of June 27, 1969 must be seen against the backdrop of life before that.
This is the New Symposium, a program from and for the homosexual community. I'm Baird Searles, and also on hand,
Kermit Lamb.
This discussion was recorded at Pacifica Radio New York just 6 months before the historic event.
I have felt, and I think I've changed even my thinking on this in the last 3 or 4 years, is that homosexuals aren't proud enough to be homosexuals and get out and you know, be militant a little bit and say I am, and a little like I'm glad to see now in the racial thing that Negroes now aren't just trying to get along like everybody else. They've seen beauty in their own blackness.
Yeah.
Black is beautiful.
It bears on what you're saying about being proud of homosexual, which I think even at now is a little much to ask of most people, but just being open about it. Since doing this program, and kind of because of doing this program and trying to find people to do this program back at the beginning, it has come so sharply to my attention the total lack of courage that the homosexual community has. And I know the reasons, damn it, and I've been through it myself. I think that is one thing you can really pin on all of you out there is cowardice. I know I'm going to get letters saying, okay, it's easy for you. You're not going to get fired from the station. But it hasn't been that easy. The feeling that I've totally lost contact with my father because of this program. Mm. And I know that people's lives can be ruined if they open up and reveal themselves. On an idealistic plane, we all know that if every homosexual said what he was tomorrow, that the whole situation would be changed for the better. Now, this is obviously a pipe dream. But for every homosexual that does open up and reveal himself, there are that many more people that realize that homosexuals are real, breathing human beings. They are not sex maniacs or freaks. That many more young people that are given the fact that a homosexual life needn't be a disaster.
I know a number of people who are under 25, say, under 20, they all seem to be much more relaxed. I hope it's a sign.
I don't know.
There's a certain feeling among many younger people of not caring who knows. They have straight friends who know, and I hope this is sort of indicative of something.
Gay is power! Gay is power! Gay is power! Gay is proud! Gay is power!
June 27th, 1969, as recalled in Brett Artery's 1970 documentary.
The disorders began with a routine police raid on a homosexual bar, the Stonewall, on Christopher Street. Almost every homosexual who was in New York at the time of the Stonewall Rebellion has his own private memory of what took place. One of the longtime leaders of the gay rights movement, Craig Rodwell, remembers it this way.
The first night was Friday. I was on the way home from a friend's house. The raid was just starting at that time, and we noticed the crowd. We went over there, and a crowd was gathering out in front. There was a paddy wagon pulled up and a few people being taken out. It started with those few coins and pebbles being thrown at the police, and then the police retreated into the stone wall. And then after the police barricaded themselves inside, it was like half an hour later, the riot police started moving up Christopher, breaking up the crowd, which had really become a very angry crowd with hundreds of bottles and rocks. There wasn't one window left in the whole place after about 10 minutes. And they broke the crowd up into small groups, and this went on for like 2 or 3 hours, back and forth in the whole area. I think they thought the people would just go home or run. Especially since they were gay people. They're not used to gay people standing up at all, especially in front of police. But they would chase people away, and they would go around the block and come in another way. And this sort of tug of war went on all evening. And then on Saturday night, it was much the same thing. Starting about 9, crowds started to gather in the area. And then around 11 or 12, they started taking over the street, and stopping cars from coming through, unless there were gay people in them. A few fires were set. But generally, there's an angry mood, a lot of chanting, a lot of hand-holding, a lot of assertion of being gay. It was a way of saying we're tired of hiding, tired of leading two lives, tired of denying our basic identity, denying ourselves, newfound pride, really, a collective pride in their identity.
Another important outgrowth of the riots was the formation of numerous action-oriented homosexual groups in New York and around the country. They're composed for the most part of younger and more militant homosexuals.
It still is a relatively small minority of gay people who do reflect this new spirit, whatever you want to call it. I think it's going to infect the masses of gay people in the coming years.
Gay power is here to stay, and nobody, nobody is going to ignore us any longer.
Hey Joe, get up and go, wouldn't like to tell you twice. Hey Mac, get off my back, didn't ask your advice. There's too much heat out in the streets, telling us to move along. Gonna be a long, hot summer.
The birth of the Gay Pride March, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. On November 2, 1969, in Philadelphia, the Eastern Regional Conference of Homophile Organizations made a resolution that sparked the creation of Gay Pride celebrations. In part, it read, "We propose that a demonstration be held annually on the last Saturday in June in New York City to commemorate the 1969 spontaneous demonstrations on Christopher Street, and this demonstration be called Christopher Street Liberation Day. No dress or age regulations shall be made for this demonstration. We also propose that we contact homophile organizations throughout the country and suggest that they hold parallel demonstrations on that day. We propose a nationwide show of support." Thus was born the Gay Pride Parade as we know it. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Dustin Richardson.
This is Gabrielle Antolovich reporting from West Hollywood for This Way Out. You know what the Stonewall riots were about?
I know a little bit about them.
What do you know?
Oh, some cops came into a bar and some Long Beach cops and
New York.
Oh, New York, okay. Well, anyway, whatever city. But anyway, they came into the bar and they were trying to break up the gays or whatever. And then the gays kicked their butt. That's what I heard.
I just heard like a whole bunch of drag queens just sort of like, you know, barricaded the whole half of the city and just, you know, took over for about a few days.
You know that it wasn't just drag queens. It was leather boys and lesbians and people of color, too.
Yeah.
You know anything about the Stonewall riots?
I don't know a thing about him.
Well, what's the gay parade about?
I guess to celebrate the gay life.
Where you can touch in public and it doesn't, I guess, offend anybody, or you can just be yourself.
You know that it's a yearly event to commemorate the Stonewall riots that happened in New York.
No!
Did you know that?
No, I knew it was Stonewall, but I didn't know why they called it that.
Maybe I don't know enough about my culture.
Of course, Age of Consent's Gay History Rap leaves off before AIDS, marriage equality, gender nonconformity, and social media. But don't worry, there's a new swing to the right these days to keep us busy. Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Wenzel Jones and Monique Lukens, with thanks to Brian DeShazer. Sugar Beach, Mary Watkins, the Berkeley Women's Music Collective, and the Tom Robinson Band performed some of the music you heard, and Tim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks to Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors who make this program possible. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WNPG Portland, Maine, KOPN Columbia, Missouri, 5GTR Mount Gambier, South Australia, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. How do the ways that we think about the past limit our visions of the future? In particular, how does our understanding of inequality in human society shape our sense of whether we can radically change our deeply unequal society today? I recently put those questions to anarchist anthropologist David Graeber, who believes so much of what we think about past societies is wrong. The internationally acclaimed writer teaches at the London School of Economics and is the author of many works, including Debt, the First 5,000 Years, and his latest, which I'm going to refer to as BS Jobs. David Graeber was recently in town, and I sat down with him for an hour to discuss human history and inequality, the influence of the native Huron leader Kondiaronk on Enlightenment thinking, and to talk about the Kurdish YPG, or People's Protection Units, fighting ISIS in Kurdish Syria while struggling for the end of patriarchy. Here's that conversation. So we learn in anthropology class that for most of human history, humans lived in tiny, egalitarian hunter-gatherer bands, and that the original sin then took place, which was with the advent of settled agriculture. People started farming. Out of that, private property, class society emerged, and then you get
cities.
And you get cities, and you get civilization, which on the one hand may allow for the flourishing of the arts, on the other hand leads to all the ills that we have lived with ever since. So that is the
The state, for example.
Exactly. And and this is the story that we get. We get it everywhere. It's a very widely established argument. What's wrong with it?
Well, pretty much everything. This story, it doesn't really come from anthropology. It really comes from the Enlightenment, people like Rousseau and even Adam Smith, you know, the sort of evolution, notion of evolutionary stages. The funny thing is that people were starting to get over it in the early part of the 20th century and realizing the story was somewhat more complicated. But somehow in the 60s, they discovered the Kalahari Bushmen and the Pygmies and kind of this paradigm for primordial innocence. You go back to this kind of Eden Utopia idea. But, you know, there's a worm in the butt because it's always assumed that, yes, human beings start innocent and almost like childlikely egalitarian. But the moment you get to any sort of large size, you can no longer, or, you know, you can no longer maintain that. As soon as there's social complexity, as soon as you have, like, people, lots of people living together, having to coordinate large projects, you necessarily need hierarchy. It's functional somehow. So thus the dream is either, you know, someday we can return to being primitive again or the equivalent thereof, or maybe somehow we can get beyond. It's never clear, but the dice are so loaded. It just seems the moment we achieve complex society, we're basically doomed. Now, the problem with this is that since then, especially since the 60s, there's been enormous new research evidence. The technology of understanding, you know, analysis has gotten much better. There's been a lot more archaeology. There's been a lot better analysis of the anthropological data. And as a result, we know that pretty much every single part of that story is factually wrong. The problem is that during the period where we've been figuring that out, there's been an incredible abandonment of any public role for archaeologists and anthropologists and most scholars, to be honest. So it's not just that people don't write for the general public. They don't write for people in other fields. They don't even write for people in other subfields. So you have this incredibly specialized knowledge that nobody's putting together. And me and my friend David Wengrow is an archaeologist. This is a pet peeve of both of ours. We kind of got together and we started going through it. That, all right, if we need another grand narrative, what would it be like? What actually happened? And so, for example, the assumption that we all lived in little Kalahari Bushmen-like bands, it's not true. Even back in 1900, they knew that hunter-gatherers actually much more typically move back and forth seasonally. So they'll live in bands for maybe part of the year, but then they kind of get together. They form these little micro-cities. Often there's monumental architecture, giant feasts and ceremonies. And very often, in fact, the typical pattern is for them to have completely different social structures in different times of year. And this continues into a lot of farming societies, pastoral societies that, you know, for example, I always like to give the example, most plains societies, indigenous societies in North America, a lot of these guys had been farmers and abandoned it and went back to hunting buffalo. And all right, those societies, for 3 months of the year, they would have something very much resembling a state. They'd have a rotating system where different warrior societies or clans would essentially have police powers, could enforce rules arbitrarily. And then during the rest of the year, the other 9 months, they'd be scattered. They do everything by consensus. They would have a completely egalitarian society. So how do you characterize that? You know, they're a band society one time of year and a state society or something very much like it for 3 months during the hunt and the big ritual season. Other ones would go back, like the Inuit, often would be very small patriarchal bands of private property. Then they get together and it was the opposite. When they all got together and built these little micro cities, they would have these giant wife swapping orgies and or wife and husband swapping, and they would like collective property arrangements. So they become egalitarian when they were all together and subvert all the hierarchies, and the hierarchies would be reasserted when they broke up into small groups. There's a million different patterns. So the evidence would imply that people are playing around with different social possibilities really from the very beginning. And if you look at the archaeological evidence, suddenly it makes a lot more sense, because what we found is there are these mysterious burials and sites that just don't seem to make sense. If you go back to the Ice Age, even 30,000, 40,000 years ago, you'll find these things that look like royal burials. They have incredible amounts of beads and, you know, scepters and carved ornaments of every kind, and they calculate how many thousands of hours it must have taken people to make this stuff. They sort of exist in magnificent isolation. There'll be suddenly this, most people weren't buried at all, but there'll be like one or two people who are buried in this incredibly magnificent way. And then it never seems to lead to anything. Or sometimes they'll have these giant monuments made of mass mammoth tusks and huge things that are clearly ceremonial. So you have these sort of princely burials are sometimes called. You have these monumental structures, but it doesn't lead to anything like a state. You know, they exist in isolation thousands of years apart. So what do you make of this? And there's an additional really weird thing, which no one seems to know what to do of. The majority of these magnificent burials are physically anomalous in some way. They're either hunchbacks or giants or dwarfs or things like that. You know, so the best explanation we can come up with is that, you know, it's almost like playing at like social forms that had never been permanently institutionalized. These people were king for the 3 month season where everybody got together on the mammoth hunt and whatever it might be that like allowed everyone to get together, and then people dispersed and went back to a completely different way of life.
And are you saying that these seem to be cyclical, or is there any evidence that there was some pushback if things became too egalitarian or too?
The evidence we have is this is hard to know, but clearly the fact that it didn't become institutionalized shows that there were structures in there to make sure that these people didn't like turn their temporary power into a way to really push people around. And there's a lot of evidence of pushback of different kinds in different times of history. One example that seems fascinating is Stonehenge. Well, there's a bunch of things we've discovered about Stonehenge now. One I always like to point out. The chemical analysis has gotten much better. So there are these things that you always found scattered around Stonehenge and similar megalithic monuments in England. They called them vase stems. They didn't really know what they were, these little cup-like things. And finally, they managed to do trace analysis of the chemicals. They discovered their hash pipes. And also, opium was very popular at the time. So basically, the people at Stonehenge then were just as stoned as they are now. So that was
what. You know, some things don't change.
Don't change, yeah. A beer only comes later. And so you have that. But the other thing is that there does seem to have been something like dynasties and kings around Stonehenge, which seems remarkable, but it's even more remarkable when you realize that these are people who not only were they not agricultural, they used to be agricultural and they gave it up. So there was a Neolithic revolution. Everybody said, you know, this is like way too much work. We're going to go back to gathering nuts again. So they kept the pigs and the sheep, but they got rid of all the grain crops. And so they were scattering for most of the year. So for 3 months a year, they'd come together and create these sort of magical courts, but they wouldn't last. And then they break up again.
What about cities and how we understand early cities? Because, of course, the assumption is this was the slide, depending on how you see it, towards greater civilization, or if you're of the sort of more anti-civ stripe,
right?
You know, to hell in a handbasket.
Yeah, and we're screwed, and that's it. Yeah. That's what's really interesting about cities is that it seems quite likely that many, not all, but many of the first cities were actually more egalitarian than whatever had come before. And this is true in Mesopotamia. If you look at the very first period in Uruk, the first maybe 1,000 years. They used to think it was much shorter, but they realized now it took quite some time. There's no signs of the temples and palaces, and you know what it looks like when there is a hierarchy there. And none of that stuff existed for the first 1,000 years. In fact, you know, what you do have is like large meeting halls clearly designed for everyone to fit in them and things like that. The Indus Valley civilization, Harappan, you know, again, like later you in Indian cities, you can tell right away where the king lived and where the wealthy lived. And in these, the biggest structures were things like large public bath systems, which were clearly designed for everybody in the city. So something's very, very different. And then there's whole civilizations that we didn't even really know about, sometimes because they were, you know, in the former socialist bloc, like the Tripolia civilization, which is through Ukraine to what's now Moldova. They had cities that were actually larger than ones that existed in Mesopotamia around this very beginning. They're sometimes twice as big, but they were all arranged as circles and circles. So there's circles of houses and circles of circles. And again, there's grave goods are all the same. There's no sense. You know, there'd be one building in each of these circles. That would clearly be the collective house, but it was but it's not like some magnificent person lived in them. They were clearly egalitarian cities. So there's a lot of those. And another interesting thing is that there's a tendency for cities to develop hierarchy and then change their minds. There's some of that in very early China, some of the early cities. There's a palace and it gets burned down. But The one I always find most fascinating is Teotihuacan. You know, Teotihuacan is a place a lot of people go to nowadays. It's got these amazing giant temples of the sun and moon. Those were built at the very beginning. And there was temples where there was mass human sacrifice. There seemed to be a clear center of government there. Something happens. It wasn't even – China was, seems to be some kind of violent revolution. They burned down the palaces. There, it wasn't even that. Something happens around 200 AD maybe where – they bury the temple where they're doing all the human sacrifice and start to stop doing that. And the city is rebuilt as this, you know, over 1,000 very large, comfortable villas, all exactly the same size. And that's where everybody lives. It's like really, really nice, like housing estates, public housing. And it stays that way for 400, 500 years. And even the art in Teotihuacan, like all the figures are exactly the same size. They're trying to telegraph here as clearly as they can. But for a very long time, archaeologists know there must be a palace. We just haven't found it yet. You know, there had to be government. It's a giant city. It was like, you know, at least 120,000 people there, and like, you know, 400, might be one of the largest cities in the world at the time. And it, there's no signs of a centralized monarchical or any other kind of government.
That's David Graeber, anthropologist and anarchist, and we're talking about what we know and what we don't know about the history of equality and inequality in human history. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So what do we know about the emergence of a more, let's just say, enduring class society where it doesn't seem to just sort of yo-yo back and forth?
Well, it's hard to say where these things come from, but the problem of scale is not the problem. We've been looking at exactly the opposite. I mean, the
scale meaning the bigger it gets.
Yeah, the bigger it gets, the more you need top-down systems of management and control. That's been the assumption for a long time. But you know, a lot of ethnographic evidence has shown the base assumptions this is based on are just not true. Irrigation systems. They used to think once you have a complex irrigation system, you need a bureaucracy to run it. But now that we've like looked at places like Bali is a great example where you have really, really complex irrigation systems. Actually, you know, there's thousands of water temples of like you know, local of elected elders, you know, who coordinate together. There is no central control. There are states, but they actually have nothing to do with all this bureaucratic, I mean, or all of this water administration that people assumed was what made states possible. So insofar as there are states and places with a lot of irrigation, it's largely because if you spent 20, 30 years building an irrigation system, you're less likely to run away when someone comes and tries to shake you down. You know? The states are parasitical off this stuff rather than organizing it themselves.
You had earlier said that although there's been all of this new scholarship, and some of it not so new, but over the last century, that scholars have been writing for these very, very specialized audiences and not for the public. But one person who has been writing for the public and who does make the argument of large-scale organization needing top-down rule and of a primordial, innocent past that we have left and must never return to is Jared Diamond.
Yes, he is.
I wonder if you could comment on his work.
Well, I don't want to say anything too mean. The important to bear in mind that Jared Diamond is a I believe his degree was in some kind of some medical thing, and then he became an ornithologist. But he's not actually an anthropologist, you know. Yeah, what he does is he just repeats the common wisdom that we're all trained to expect. And someone actually once defined – I don't like the word pop, you know. People say, oh, that's pop science. You know, sometimes they just mean like that science that you can actually understand. Mm-hmm. It's very elitist. But insofar as anyone's ever come up with a – reasonable definition of what is pop and what's wrong with it, like it would be this, that like pop theory is theory that gives you reasons you never would have thought of to believe what you already think. And that's kind of what these guys do. They come up with really clever ideas for why conventional wisdom is in fact true. And conventional wisdom isn't true. This is what Jared Diamond basically does. He gives you the same story we've been hearing for 250 years. But I'll tell you an interesting story about how he got to that conventional wisdom, which he's simply repeating, really. If you look at the Enlightenment and Enlightenment ideas, a lot of it traces back to North America and to indigenous sources. I mean, I actually think that the Enlightenment actually started in North America before the settlers actually showed up. But that's kind of a long, complicated story. One thing that I did look into in quite great detail, I looked at the French literature because it's very rich and easily accessible. There's all these Jesuit relations of, you know, what indigenous people, what First Nations in what's now Canada thought of the settlers, the missionaries, when they first showed up. You know, what was the indigenous critique? And it's interesting. It's quite consistent. It's the whole idea of egalitarian societies, which then is the way we now characterize them. It wasn't the way it started. Nobody talked on either side about equality, as they talked about freedom. So indigenous people were basically said, look, you guys just follow orders all the time. You're afraid of your commanders. I mean, we have chiefs. We just ignore them if we don't like what they say. You know, they have no power to make us do anything we don't want to do. We laugh at them. You guys run around like a bunch of slaves. And they say that. And they also say you don't take care of each other. So you know, if somebody's in trouble, nobody bails them out. You have people sleeping on the street. What the hell is wrong with you guys? And, you know, you're not nice people. But in there was a similar idea, which is that, you know, it's not inequalities of wealth that was an issue for them because, you know, some people have a lot of, you know, wampum or other, you know, treasures that were things that were considered most valuable things. People would have differential amounts of that stuff. There's no way to turn wealth into power. Just because I've got more of this than you do doesn't mean I can make you do something you don't want to do. Certainly, I can't make you work for me. Now, So at first, like a lot of the First Nation people didn't understand that that wasn't the case in French society. So they were criticizing them for not being very nice. You know, here are these people who are desperate. You don't help them out. And therefore, they're not able to be free, autonomous people. So you're not free in two ways. Sometimes you're poor and you can't be free. And even if you're not poor, if you're not the one guy who's in power, you're just following orders and you're afraid of somebody. So gradually, however, and it's very interesting because if you read the Jesuit accounts, you know, we're all used to this idea that, like, they're the Westerners, this is the Western gaze, they're basically us, and these indigenous people are some alien other. But in fact, the indigenous people are basically making the points we would make if we were there. And it's the French guys are weird, you know. So they're all, like, you know, these devout Christians, and they actually say, like, okay, these guys are the most free people who ever lived. This is a problem. We want them to become Christian. That means like 10 commandments, obedience. You know, that's like a basic principle. And they say, well, you know, the system, it doesn't seem to make any sense. They don't have any punitive laws. They just have this system of mediation and compensation and shaming. And says, and you know what? To be honest, it kind of works better than in France. Like there's less crime, actually. But that's not the point. The point is they're supposed to follow orders. If they don't understand following orders, how are they going to, like, find God? So it's exactly the opposite of the usual critique of anarchism, right? They're not saying, well, it's a lovely idea, but, like, it would never work. They say, yeah, it works fine, but it's a terrible idea. Stop that. Stop being so free. It's, like, bad. Okay, so it's all about freedom. But then gradually the indigenous, like, the indigenous observers, they start going to French towns. They build up Montreal. Some of them travel to New York and places like that. They get sent diplomatic missions to France. And gradually they sort of figure out, oh, I see. It's all about money and property. You guys have a system where you can take wealth and make that into a way to push people around, which just hadn't even occurred to them before. Because that potential didn't really exist in any developed sense or any sense often in their own societies. So then, okay, the key moment, there's this guy named Lahontan, Baron Lahontan. In the 1680s, he's a teenager, sort of aristocrat from an impoverished family. They lose their inheritance. He joins the army, send him to Canada. He learns Huron and Algonquian, hangs out with a lot of indigenous people, becomes friends with this guy named Kandiyohonk, who's actually, I think, one of the most important figures in the last several hundred years of intellectual history. And gradually he gets in trouble. He has to run off. He's basically a wanted man in France. He's living homeless in Amsterdam for a while, but he starts writing these books of his memoirs, which are insanely successful, ends up in the same court as Leibniz and lives happily ever after. This book that's a big bestseller is called Curious Conversations with an Interesting Savage Who Has Traveled to France. This guy, basically, it's about Kandiyohonk. But and calls him a Dario.
And how do you spell his name?
K-A-N-D-I-A-R-O-N-K. It's usually spelled of an O, but like as people now, Iroquoian speakers say, it can't really be an O. Anyway, this guy is sometimes he's just called Le Rat, the rat, because that's what the name means. He was a Huron statesman, and everybody assumed that this guy was like a sock puppet. He was some guy Lalantan made up. But a bunch of indigenous scholars have gone through the material and say, no, everybody says he was a real guy. He was the most eloquent person anybody had ever met. He was this brilliant politician who was always outwitting the French. But he also, there was this little salon where he was so good at arguing that they would invite him to the governor's house. And they sit around to debate Christianity or debate, like, you know, social organization and what's better, which are better ways. And Lalantan took notes on all this stuff. So it was an actual, these were actual conversations. And the arguments he made are exactly the same ones you find other, you know, indigenous Iroquoian speakers especially. He has a hilarious critique of Christianity. And back then, you know, the book comes out in 1704. So you couldn't actually make fun of Christianity. The only thing you could do is have somebody else do it, pretend to be arguing with them, and make sure you always lose the argument. and so this is what happens. Basically, almost all the arguments, which are later to become enlightenment sort of arguments, the anti-clerical stuff, the egalitarian stuff, it all comes from Lalantan and thus comes from Kandirak. This book's a huge bestseller.
So you're saying that's the origin of Enlightenment thinking.
A lot of the Enlightenment radicalism. And what we now think of as egalitarian thought comes from this guy, who's like a Huron Wendat, giving like what was a really sophisticated, because he was incredibly brilliant, version of the standard Wendat critique of French people. And it turns out he had been to Paris. They sent him out a delegation to meet Louis XIV and so forth and so on. So he had a chance to observe it himself. Okay, here's where it gets interesting. So this guy, the book becomes a huge hit. Every single Enlightenment thinker writes a imitation of it. Voltaire has a half-Huron guy. Let's see, Diderot is a Polynesian. Rousseau, we all know what he does. Basically, all of these guys sort of take it up. So the idea of how you critique French societies, pretend to be an indigenous person, and use these same kind of arguments. It all comes to a peak with a woman named Madame Givenchy. She is one of the Salonists, and she writes a one where it's an imaginary sort of indigenous feminist critique. It's an Inca princess who's kidnapped to France. This is 1755, like 50 years later, and making fun of French society. It's actually a feminist milestone because it's the first novel we know of with a female protagonist who doesn't either marry or die at the end. But, okay, so this Inca princess is sort of making fun of French society. The book's a huge hit. Big bestseller. She has to do a second edition. So we have her correspondence. She sent around copies to her friends saying, I need to change it around a little for the second edition. What should I do? So it goes to Turgot, who's, as we know, the guy who invents the idea of progress, right? But this is like the moment we can, you know, in this correspondence, we can see it happen. He's reading this book and he's saying, I don't know. This is kind of, I don't know, the political implications of this is kind of disturbing because, like, okay, sure, we're all for freedom and equality and in principle, but can you maintain a complex commercial society like that? Well, you know, I think you should have her realize at the end of the book that there are stages of development, evolution. And this is like where evolution is first proposed, as far as we know.
Sounding very familiar.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and then, like, you know, when you're a hunter-gatherer or something like that, sure, you can have this. And even as a farmer in the Incas, but, you know, as soon as you get up to the complex stage of modern, they didn't have industry yet, you know, modern commercial society, then you need to have a division of labor, you need to have hierarchy, and she should realize that because the payoff in terms of prosperity is, you know, greater than the sacrifice and freedom and equality. And she says, yeah, like, how could I put that in? Never mind. But so she ignores him. But the next year, he gives this great speech on the idea of progress where he develops this. Adam Smith takes it up. Before you know it, you have evolution. But so the whole notion of stages of evolutionary development is actually invented as a direct response to the indigenous critique of European society, which is like incredibly popular.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and I'm joined by anarchist anthropologist David Graeber. He's the author of a number of books, including On Kings, Debt, the First 5,000 Years, and the book BS Jobs. That's the FCC-compliant version of the title.
Isn't kind of guess what the title might be.
Indeed. And I'm Sasha Lilly. So to talk about political implications,
yes.
What are the political implications of imagining that for most of human history, we lived in a egalitarian way, but we were in these very small units? And then after that, you know, the original sin of settled agriculture, we lost all of that. We became these complex, larger and larger societies. The state emerged, class society emerged.
Mm-hmm.
On the one hand, you might say, well, but doesn't that allow us to believe that at one point, actually for the majority of our history, we lived in an egalitarian way? On the other hand, the implication may be that that is a world that is now closed to us. How do you see it?
Well, I mean, yes, the idea was we lived in an egalitarian way, but it's always followed by the assumption that since the fall, you know, since we sought after knowledge inappropriately, we're stuck, you know. Whereas if you look at this narrative that's beginning to emerge of what seems to have actually happened, and I haven't even gone into the actual origins of agriculture, which are much different than people assume, and, you know, if agriculture creates social inequality, why does it take 4,000 years for any changes to occur? You know, if you look at what really happened, what you see is that people are adults. They're not children who've not figured out inequality, and as soon as it happens to them, they're kind of stuck there. They're playing around with different possibilities. We've always been self-conscious about social possibilities. You know, if we are anything as humans, as people have some control over the condition of our existence, we make our own worlds. And it used to be not that we were like these innocent creatures who had never let sort of open Pandora's box. It's much more a matter of we used to have more control. We used to actually be able to say, all right, we will create hierarchies for 3 months and then rip them down again. And people would literally build these monuments and then rip them down again. And somehow, so the normal state of human affairs is to move back and forth between different social possibilities, to play around. So hierarchies exist almost in play form before they exist in real form. So the question is how we got stuck in one mode. It's like we were playing this costume drama and suddenly we forgot we were playing a costume drama, and here we have been ever since. Yeah, that's what happened. As Marshall Sollins points out, you know, states exist in the imagination. Like, you know, people imagine these all-powerful gods who can punish you for infractions and impose codes on you. You know, in hunter-gatherer societies, we're nothing like a state apparatus at all. So people are imagining all these things. But somehow we end up stuck in one mode of, and it's a particularly awful mode.
And is it clear, is there a timeline that could be agreed on of when we got stuck?
Well, at different times and places, because sometimes we got unstuck. And that's the other thing which is important. Like, okay, this is if you look at the story of Kandiyarank, I think the other interesting thing we learn, so they came up with this idea of evolution. We still have people say, oh, there were bands and then there were tribes and then they get chiefdoms and you get kingdoms and states. But if you look at the history of North America that produced people like that, that's not what happened at all. You know, you have like these hunter-gatherer societies which go back and forth between bands and concentrations. You have the Hopewell civilization, which is not even agricultural, where they're building these astrological giant monuments and crazy ritual centers. And then that turns into suddenly into a state. They just leap directly into a state. Cahokia, it seems almost like this giant empire, this huge city, bigger than anything that exists any before or after in North America, in what's now East St. Louis. So they go from hunter-gatherers to bam, you know, like this empire. Then the empire dissolves, and we don't know why. And that area where it used to be becomes like a forbidden zone on Planet of the Apes or something. Like nobody lives anywhere nearby for hundreds of years. And, okay, then you get chiefdoms coming out of that. Then those chiefdoms collapse and turn into these sort of polis-sized republics where everybody's sitting around and, you know, smoking tobacco and drinking caffeinated beverages and discussing politics, is what I'm saying. It's a sort of proto-enlightenment happening in North America before the Europeans even show up. And those are like, you know, like the Cherokee or the Osage or, you know, people like that. And sometimes they hit, you know, if you look at Cherokee myths, they're really direct. They say, yeah, once upon a time there used to be this hereditary caste of priests and they used to push us around and abuse women and do terrible things. So we killed them all and now we don't have hereditary leadership. I mean, they're just like totally direct, right? And somehow people won't put two and two together. So, you know, the settlers show up and they find these guys who are staunchly egalitarian or like they're hippies talking about nature and being one with the cosmos. And it doesn't occur to them that this is, you know, maybe a political thing. You know, there used to be these, you know, all around them, there's these giant mounds of what used to be cities, like abandoned. And like, here's these like guys saying, oh, no, no, we're against any kind of hierarchy. It never occurs to them to put two together that, you know, what you're actually seeing of guys like Kondiaronk is the egalitarian ideology that formed in reaction to and probably overthrew all of these like urban civilizations and empires and so forth. So politics exists at all times. So, you know, it's not like once we're stuck, we can't get unstuck. He got unstuck. And then, of course, you know, the settlers came and killed them all. But nonetheless, the history is full of these kind of movements and possibilities.
Which, obviously, we have a complete amnesia about now. And the implication is that there's clearly been increased concern about inequality. Mm-hmm. But the implication still is that to become egalitarian means to return to forms that are no longer possible.
Yes. And it's, I'd actually even think the word inequality is kind of loaded.
Yeah.
Because what does it mean? You know, I mean, what would a absolutely equal society be like? I mean,
and you write that rather than using words like class power, we don't hear that.
Yeah.
Inequality kind of lends itself as a term to milquetoast solutions.
Yeah, technocratic, you know, let's tinker around a little bit, adjust the Gini coefficient. I think a little too much wealth is concentrating. You know, let's distribute it a little more that way. Maybe the tax system should be skewered that way. And yeah, so it's basically about going to, like, you know, the G8 summit and readjusting and, you know, proposing ideas to, like, rejigger things rather than fundamentally change structures, because they're assumed. It's obviously we're not going to have a society where everybody's exactly the same. I mean, come on, who would want that? So, you know, and I go back to that indigenous critique, and I think one of the really interesting things about it is that they weren't talking about equality. That equality discourse only comes when they discover that you can turn wealth into power. But that's exactly what they were really objecting to. You know, instead of talking about equality, you know, what they were really saying and I think what people actually object to about what they call social inequality is not that, like, you know, you got a bigger house. I mean, maybe, okay, or maybe you'll have a bigger house and I have more books and you have, you know, well, there's things are incommensurable anyway, right? What they're objecting to is that some people can turn their wealth into power and push people around, and that other people who do not have things are considered unimportant and their perspectives and lives and needs don't matter. So that's the thing that people are objecting to, not the actual number of things people have. So if you can get – and you can't, you know, exactly adjust things so that everybody has the same, nor would you really want to. But you can get rid of a system where people can turn wealth into the ability to push the people around, and a system where anybody is told, I don't care what you want.
Is there the other side for the not very large population relative to those with sort of mainstream notions about what is possible and what is not possible, but for those people still, you know, burning the torch of the radical left?
Yes,
that if
like
you,
me.
That if we no longer imagine that so much of human history was just simply equality, not some oscillation back and forth, then how can we imagine a future that is one of equality that isn't, I don't know, market socialism or some variation back and forth between equality and inequality?
Right. I mean, I think that the word freedom has been fallen into disrepute. People don't like it. They assume that it's a bourgeois liberal concept. Of course, that's ironic since, as I was pointing out, it really, more than anything else, first of all, comes out of movements of slaves. Freedom is the opposite of slavery. And second of all, the sort of indigenous people who have the certain notion of inherent liberty and autonomy of the individual, which is then adopted, you know, in Europe, which is a society which wasn't like that at all, you know. Be this as it may, I think that our, you know, it's you can learn something from those societies. What they're essentially saying is it's not the equality that matters. It's when equality impedes on people's ability to autonomously or collectively decide for themselves how they want to live, and where it turns into an ability to basically push people around and tell people to do things they don't want to do. So I think we need to reimagine what the purpose of these economic and social arrangements are. What it is we're actually trying to achieve. There are non-liberal notions of freedom, and we need to recuperate those.
Well, and to just extend that a bit further, the implications of all of this for the present, for the future. Clearly, we live in times where what people tend to expect for the future is not particularly sunny. Obviously, global warming adds to that, but also the sense of the possible, the politically possible, given the past and the recent past. And one aspect of that, which actually global warming has a part to play in, is this notion that we might be able to live in a way that is more equal, more free, and also more sustainable. And
the degrowth, for example.
Right. And so the implication is, no, it is not possible on the sort of scale that we all live in to be able to live differently. And the only way to even consider it would be a radical scaling back. It sounds like you're mounting a defense of the ability for us to live in radically free and egalitarian ways on a large scale.
Yeah, because this happened before. And you know, it's the evidence is right in front of our eyes, and we just refuse to see it. You know, here you have these giant egalitarian cities that used to exist not that far away, you know. And we're just sort of saying, no, that can't be true. That didn't happen because it can't, you know. It's similar to when I talk about the BS jobs. You'll have people say, well, we have a market system, so nobody would hire someone to what isn't economically advantageous to them. So therefore, the fact that 40% of the population feels they're doing pointless jobs, they must all be wrong. Can't be happening because, you know, our basic picture of the way society works says it can't be happening, so it isn't. I don't care what empirical evidence you put in front of my eyes. It's very similar with history. We just don't see what's in front of us. There's all the negative space in the picture. You know, if you just flip it around, the picture looks really different. One thing that David Wengrow points out, he's worked on a lot of work in Egypt. So if you – no one's quite sure how to do the numbers, but there's what they call interdynastic periods. Interdynastic periods is when they didn't actually have a pharaoh. It's like the interregnum. You assume that's like 10, 20 years, but actually no. There's like several hundred usually. And in fact, it's quite possible that there's more interdynastic periods than there are dynastic periods in ancient Egyptian history. In other words, for like at least half the time, there was no pharaoh. There was no giant monuments being built. So what were they doing then? We just ignore that. You know, why don't we write a history of Egypt in which pharaohs are the exception, and normally they're just getting on with their lives without them? So there's a lot more happening in history than we imagine. And if we go back, we discover that social possibilities are much, much richer than we would be inclined to imagine.
David Graeber is my guest. He is professor of anthropology at the London School of Economics. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So looking back at least what we can tell, what we can divine, because some of this obviously isn't always clear, about the range of possibilities and the ways that societies have shifted back and forth between varying degrees of equality and inequality, you're saying, and of course, it's fairly obvious to see that we are live in a time where that dynamic is stuck, that the oscillation. Yeah.
We're stuck in one mode.
We're stuck in one mode, and switching to the other mode seems very hard to conceive of. Are there any indications looking back about what unsticks something that's stuck, or is there anything that you would extrapolate from the past in thinking about the present?
Yeah. I mean, there's a big debate about that right now, but there's people like Scheidel. I don't know if you know him, or wrote a book where he tried to argue that the only thing that's really like stopped galloping inequality has been catastrophe.
Yes,
and I don't think that's the true.
This is a writer on the right.
Yes, he's a right wing, like a Walter Scheidel. He's like kind of our nemesis. And on the one hand, he's written some very interesting, perceptive stuff about money that I used when I was writing Debt. The other, he sort of went off the deep end, in my opinion, and came with this incredibly pessimistic approach. And I'm, on the other hand, like things that look historically like catastrophes and disasters, because we're reading a history that's written by rich and powerful people, actually, you know, probably look really different if you were on the bottom of the social hierarchy. So look at the Dark Ages, where everything is supposed to collapse. You know, if you're talking about the Roman Empire, they have all these cities which are basically, you know, fed by slave labor. Or, you know, for every person who's like declaiming poetry in you know, Roman Damascus, there's like five guys like living their entire lives being peons in Egypt, you know, producing grain for them. And all right, so you know, in the Dark Ages, those five guys got free. You know, 40% by some estimation, probably exaggerated, but 30% of the population of Roman Italy were slaves. After the Goths, Visigoths, Vandals, and Huns came through, none of them were slaves. I mean, so it might have been disaster for the Senate, who got massacred, and a lot of the, you know, sort of middle class people really suffered, but slaves did pretty well, you know. I mean, so Dark Age for whom exactly? So again, you know, something really interesting happened across Eurasia in those years of the sort of beginning of the Middle Ages, where slavery was essentially abolished in most of Eurasia. How did that happen? It's one of the great historic, must have been a social movement of some kind. In Europe, it had to have something to do with the church, but we don't know what, because almost no church father is actually against slavery. Yet somehow they reached a situation where all the slaves got freed. How did that happen? You know, things like that have happened throughout history, and even in the midst of disasters. I don't think it necessarily has to go through catastrophe and disaster, but there has to be disruption and reshuffling of the deck. Sometimes that cannot be pretty, but if you look at what's going on right now, you know, we're living through some pretty non-pretty times if you happen to be in many parts of the world. Question is what will come of it. So I think that we're also living in unprecedented times because things happen faster and communications are so much quicker than they were before, that it's possible to have transformations that are coordinated across the world in ways that never happened before. I think the social possibilities for change are dramatic. What they've been doing for the last 30 or 40 years has been trying to convince us of the opposite, that somehow the rise of technology, information systems, all this incredibly rapid computer stuff has created a situation where our social possibilities are dramatically less than they were before. I always point this out to people. I had an argument with Peter Thiel about this, actually. He pointed out,
Peter Thiel, the right-wing libertarian founder of PayPal.
Yeah. Because we were talking about technological stagnation, which is something we both agree with and think is a problem. And I actually said, okay, think about it this way. You know, for most of human history, there were 20, you know, when people were carting around wheat and ox carts, there are 27 different ways, like, you could organize an economy. Now we have super fast computers, and supposedly now there's just one. I thought technology was supposed to increase our social possibilities. And he was like, yeah, I guess you got a point. There probably are other ways we could organize the economy. We just haven't thought of them yet. And I, you know, if you had all the guys who were sitting around figuring out how ways to do, like, you know, really super fast trading derivatives, and had said, no, come up with something other than capitalism as a way of, like, distributing goods and services, I'm sure they'd come up with 20 different alternative economies in a matter of weeks, you know, if we had all those guys with something interesting to do for a change. The only reason they haven't is because, you know, there's been this intense and continual effort to basically kill the human imagination and tell us, no, forget it. Don't even think about another way. Don't even think about another system.
And some of that entails assumptions about human nature. We're told that human nature is a particular way, and that just can't be changed.
Right. But if that were true, you wouldn't have had the 37 different ways of organizing economies before this. So then they try to rewrite history and say, well, it might look like other systems, but really it was the same, for which they have to cook the books in all sorts of crazy ways. Yeah, it's a way of. I mean, it's crazy. Things that, like, are treated as inevitable that didn't even exist 20 years ago. I noticed this in the UK. Like, they got rid of free education under Blair, you know, in the 90s. And then they massively increased the tuition in 2010 to huge protests. And nowadays there's a student movement for Restore Free Education, which has been adopted by the opposition party now. And, you know, when I first propose it, the first reaction you get from hundreds of people is, how could that be possible? We could not possibly afford, where is that money going to come from to afford free education? It's like, okay, we live in England. To the north, Scotland, they still have free higher education. To the west, Ireland, they still have free education. France, Belgium, Germany, every single country anywhere around us has this, and you're saying it's inconceivable. How could you possibly say such a thing? So it's really fascinating how that brainwashing works.
Let me end by asking you about how you think that radicals can help push things in a way that we can unstick the situation that we're stuck in. Mm. I mean, the prevailing ideology, as you've described, is one of a hopelessness about any change beyond the present. The present is the best we can expect.
A cultivated hopelessness, yes.
Indeed.
Yes.
So how can we struggle against that hopelessness? And I don't mean in terms of a cheering squad, but how does one counter, how should radicals counter that ideological campaign in a way that you think might be effective, shifting things in a different direction?
We need to look at both what's happened in the past and also what's happening now. I mean, one of the things that fascinates me, and this is, I think, a symptom of this sort of collapse and abandonment of the responsibility for hope. I mean, I really think that you know, if we can't know whether a good society is possible, which we can't, this is what Chomsky makes this argument, I kind of agree with him on this one. You know, he says, well, why not just assume that it is? If you can't know, better to, like, live with hope, you know? I say it's a responsibility to others to do that. You know, I mean, I'd go further. I think there is a responsibility to actually look at the possibilities for improvement and take the risk, you know? I mean, that they are possible. But if you look around, I mean, what people do is the opposite. They look around and they just can't believe that good things really are happening when they are. I mean, the example I always give is Kurdistan, is Rojava, where I just got back from another visit to Rojava a few weeks ago. And I find it...
And this is where the YPG is fighting against...
Against the remains of ISIS and now against Turkey, which basically had been the sponsor of ISIS all along. But now kind of dropped the pretense and attacked them directly.
Have embraced a radical ideology, radical politics.
Yes. The philosophy, which is largely developed... Well, I mean, it's emerged from the PKK and there's sort of movements of women within the PKK sort of challenged its old Marxist ideology, and gradually Öcalan, who's the sort of intellectual leader of the PKK, embraced this stuff. And especially while he's been in prison, he's been reading a lot of Murray Bookchin and sort of took up the idea of social ecology, democratic confederalism, but doing a Kurdish version of that with a very, very strong, you know, emphasis not just on ecology but on women's rights. And you know, replacing the notion of proletarian revolution as women's revolution, gender has to come first. So basically when I was in Rojava, people said quite frequently, they'd said, well, you know, we're anti-capitalist, but we've learned from the 20th century that you can't get rid of capitalism without getting rid of the state, and you can't get rid of the state without getting rid of patriarchy. Well, how to get rid of patriarchy? It's going to be a long and complicated process, but making sure all women have access to automatic weapons, that's a start, you know. So, you know, all those images you see of women with machine guns, that's not a coincidence. That's also not just like, oh, they're desperate, they'll arm anybody. No, it's very, very self-conscious feminist ideology going on there. And the fascinating thing to me is why – you know, aren't revolutionaries all over the world saying, oh, my God, it's, you know, Spain 1937-6 all over again. You know, I mean, some are, right? But the reaction on the part of, like, probably majority at first of leftist organizations is this can't be real. They're faking it. They're pretending to be, like, libertarian communists and eco-feminists, you know, just to get our attention. Which is, of course, first of all, deeply racist, but even aside from that, I mean, it's like the most narcissistic, absurd position I've ever heard. It's like, that's right. They're a bunch of Stalinists, is the line. But in order to get, like, you know, Western left support, they're pretending to be anarchists. Like, sure, if I wanted to fake an ideology to get international support, I'd choose anarchism. That's going to happen. They're not total idiots. You know, if you're going to fake an ideology, you're going to pretend to either be a liberal or an Islamist. Those guys have guns. They have tanks and planes they'll give you. It's absurd. Yeah. But it shows something about the sort of defeatism that people just can't believe it's really happening.
Well, let me leave it right there. David Graeber, it's been a great pleasure to talk to you today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to be allowed to come here and rant with you.
David Graeber is an anarchist anthropologist, author of many books. Mm-hmm. He teaches at the London School of Economics, and his books include The Utopia of Rules, On Kings, and his latest is B.S. Jobs. If you Google it, you'll find the full name. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time.
Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.